You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Flashpoints.
Welcome to the best of Flashpoints for the week of August 26, 2016. My name is Mike Biggs. Today on the program, we talk with Code Pink activist Medea Benjamin on the U.S. defense industry providing arms to the Saudi government, now responsible for the rise in the killing of non-combatants in Yemen, including women and children. Also, we talk with attorney Brian Concannon of the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti about the 10,000-plus victims of cholera that was brought into the country by the United Nations in 2010 and the attempts by the world body to cover it up. Later, we'll feature the latest episode in our weekly series, The Flashpoints Election Crimes Bulletin, with best-selling author and investigative journalist Greg Pallast. All this straight ahead on the Best of Flashpoints. Stay tuned. You're listening to the Best of Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We kick off today's show with an interview from Monday's program with Code Pink activist Medea Benjamin on the U.S. defense industry providing arms to the Saudi government, now responsible for the rise in the killing of non-combatants in Yemen, including women and children.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. And the situation in Yemen is dire. We are seeing many images coming out of the effects of a Saudi coalition, what's called a Saudi coalition bombing campaign there. It includes the bombing of hospitals, the bombing of schools. Our next guest, Medea Benjamin, she's with Code Pink. She is a longtime anti-war activist, well-known here in the San Francisco Bay Area. Medea, welcome back to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio.
Hey, Kevin, thanks for having me on.
Well, I don't think a lot of people, and certainly myself, sort of know the background, or are intimate with the background of Yemen and why the U.S. is aiding the Saudis or selling them ammunition and bombs that are being used, or they're being accused of used to kill civilians. Can you explain that to us?
Well, that's a pretty simple one. Money, greed, U.S. weapons industry. The Saudis have become the number one purchaser of U.S. weapons. Under the Obama administration, the sales have gone through the roof, $110 billion during his time in office. That's record-breaking, Kevin. That's more than we've ever sold anywhere, much less to one country like Saudi Arabia.
So why is the U.S. supporting or not responding to the criticisms of Saudi Arabia killing civilians? I mean, can you explain to us what's going on in Yemen itself? Why? What are the politics behind that, and why are the Saudis bombing civilians there?
Well, first, just a thumbnail sketch of what's going on in Yemen. They had their own Arab Spring in which they got rid of a dictator, Ali Abdullah Saleh. The vice president became the president, Hadi. He was supposed to be there only for a transition. The transition dragged out. A group called the Houthis felt that they were being shafted. They rose up. They are a kind of a Shia-related group. The Saudis thought, uh-oh, this is the way that Iranians are going to get a toehold in our neighboring country. We better go in there and bomb the Houthis, get rid of them. They thought it would be a quick and easy thing to do. They started in March of last year, and they haven't been able to even get the Houthis out of the capital city, Sana'a. In the meantime, they have killed many thousands of civilians, displaced about 2 million people, and left about 20 million people in need of humanitarian aid, destroyed infrastructure, destroyed schools, hospitals, and created a catastrophe.
Well, we've also seen images, or I've been seeing images, if you just do a search of Yemen, that actually, I believe it was on Saturday, there was a huge rally, a pro-Hutu rally in the capital of Sana'a. There were nearly 100,000 people in that rally. There are lots of photographs out on the web right now. And basically, the Saudis attacked it as well. They started dropping bombs during this huge rally inside of the capital. What about the human toll here? Why aren't we hearing more about the civilian casualties that many are linking to U.S. policy in support of the Saudi government?
We should be hearing more, and unfortunately our media isn't showing us the pictures of the Yemeni children who've been bombed in their schools and their homes. And I think that's partially because the Saudis have hired so many PR firms and legal groups. They have 8 registered foreign agents in Washington, D.C. One of them, the Podesta Group, was started by Tony and John Podesta. John Podesta is the chairperson of Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign. They have friends in high places. They've paid for silence and complicity. They give money to Ivy League universities, to think tanks ranging from the Clinton Foundation to the Carter Center, the Atlantic Council, Brookings Institute. And so the U.S. has given the Saudis cover, diplomatic cover, but also intelligence and logistical cover. That is why some people like Senator Chris Murphy, one of the few speaking out, has said that the U.S. is totally complicit in war crimes that are being committed in Yemen today.
Well, it's interesting. I don't know if you've heard this, but California Congressman Ted Lieu actually is trying now to reactivate in Congress a move to begin to limit or to end U.S. support that may be linked to the Saudi, so-called Saudi coalition bombing campaign in Yemen. He's quoted in The Intercept today as saying, "I taught the law of war when I was on active duty. You can't kill children, newlyweds, doctors, and patients. Those are exempt targets under the law of war, and the coalition has been repeatedly striking civilians. So it's very disturbing to me. It's even worse that the U.S. is aiding this coalition." Now, that's Congressman Ted Lieu here in California. I'm wondering, what is this coalition that he keeps referring to, and what is the U.S. role in that?
Well, it's really not much of a coalition. It's really the Saudis and the U.S. That's the largest extent of the coalition. And Ted Lieu is one of very few congresspeople who are speaking out. He's trying to stop now the latest round of weapon sales that was just announced last week by the administration. This is $1.15 billion of weapons at the very time after the lull in fighting when peace talks were happening. The Saudis have resumed their bombing campaign with a vengeance. So Ted Lieu, along with people like John Conyers, there are some Republicans as well, and in the Senate we have Rand Paul, they're saying that they're going to try to block this latest round of weapons. The way it works, Kevin, is that when the administration announces a new sale of weapons overseas, Congress has 30 days to block that sales. It hasn't done it at all in the past. It would be quite a miracle if they did it this time. But we have to believe in miracles, and as part of that, we have to really be pushing our senators and our congresspeople to say enough is enough. I think all of your listeners should pick up the phone even right now and call Feinstein and Boxer, call your congressperson, and demand no more weapon sales to Saudi. This would send a huge signal to Saudi Arabia if we manage to block the sale of weapons or even manage to get a large number of congresspeople to come close to blocking them, because it's never been done in the past.
Now, do we have a sense of who these U.S. companies are that are selling these arms?
Oh, yes, definitely. One of the big beneficiaries is General Dynamics, also Boeing, Northrop Grumman. It's all the top weapons manufacturers. They have been concerned about a downturn in weapon sales internally in the United States, and they thought, aha, the Saudis can make up that difference and more. So their lobbyists have been hard at work to push for these weapon sales, to push the Saudis to buy weapons they don't even need and they don't even know how to use. In fact, it's the U.S. that keeps these weapons going and keeps the jets moving and refuels the jets in the air. The Saudis would never be able to do this without not only the purchase of U.S. weapons, but the U.S. logistical support.
Well, and we also have to say that although the U.S. is a large part of this, we also have France authorizing arm licenses worth $18 billion to Saudi Arabia last year. And Britain gave $4 billion worth of licenses to Saudi Arabia, right?
And so did the Canadians have a large, in fact, they become the number one weapons purchaser from Canada, from the U.K., and the lovely Scandinavian country of Sweden that we usually look towards for positive examples is a large weapons manufacturer. There's been a big uproar in Sweden where the foreign minister, a feminist, said she was going to stop these weapon sales. And she got such backlash by the business community that she had to back down. But we are working with a coalition in Europe and Canada to jointly be calling for an end to weapon sales. And in fact, the European Union did call for an end to weapon sales. It's not binding, but it sent a very strong signal to the individual European countries that continue to sell weapons to the Saudis.
Now, just I think people in this country need to know, is there an advantage to us, to our economy? I mean, is our economy addicted at this point, like a junkie to heroin on defense contract sales, on the defense industry? Are we beneficiaries of this, or is this actually against the interests of the common working person in this country, Medea? What's your opinion on that?
I think when you look at Saudis, you can see how they have been fostering two addictions in the United States. One is the addiction to oil, pumping cheap oil into the market to destroy the possibilities of really moving into the sustainable green economy. And then the weapons purchases. Does it benefit us? No, neither of those do. They benefit a handful of wealthy corporations. But I think when you look at what has to be done, we have to break away from both the oil economy and the war economy. And I think part of that is to separate ourselves from the Saudis. That's why I wrote a new book called The Kingdom of the Unjust, Behind the U.S.-Saudi Connection. I just started a 100-city speaking tour trying to get people to realize how toxic this relationship is and how it keeps us on this war economy that our congresspeople then say, oh, we couldn't possibly stop the production of these weapons because this represents jobs in my district. Well, you know, there's jobs and there's jobs. We need clean, good jobs that that build our country in a positive way for us and the rest of the world, not jobs that build machines to keep people and keep us hated around the world.
Give the name of the book again, Medea.
It's called Kingdom of the Unjust, Behind the U.S.-Saudi Connection.
Kingdom of the Unjust, Behind the U.S.-Saudi Connection by Medea Benjamin. I understand you're actually going to be here in the San Francisco Bay Area on November the 15th, sponsored by KPFA. You'll be doing a book signing and a presentation here locally in Berkeley. Medea, you're on that tour now. What'd you say, 100 cities?
Yes.
Wow.
And I just started this week. It's been very exciting, very timely because of this immediate need to stop this latest round of weapons. But I do look forward to being back in the Bay Area and connecting with people, and hope people will have a chance to buy the book because it's really a primer. It's kind of the basics of what you need to know about Saudi Arabia internally, how it runs its own country and deals with its own people, how it has spread Wahhabism around the world, and how it deals not only with the U.S., but its neighbors and the rest of the world, and then what we can do about it.
Listening to the best of Flashpoints for the week of August 26, 2016. My name is Mike Biggs. Up next, we feature an interview from Tuesday's program with attorney Brian Kincannon of the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti about the 10,000-plus victims of cholera that was brought into the country by the United Nations in 2010.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and I'm Kevin Pina, filling in for Dennis Bernstein. We now turn our attention back to Haiti, where the United Nations just recently admitted that it was indeed responsible for bringing a deadly strain of cholera to that country, with more than 9,000 dead. An organization, the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti, actually filed a civil suit against the United Nations and U.S. courts on behalf of the victims. Most recently, a Second Circuit Court of Appeal denied the appeal of the claim filed on behalf of the victims. Now joining me is the director of the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti to help us understand more about that, Brian Kincannon. Welcome back to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio.
Thanks for having me, Kevin. It's good to be with you.
So let's just sort of break this down. This happens in November of 2010. Let's take it from there.
The cholera hit in November of 2010 and very quickly got throughout the countryside of Haiti and into the major cities. It's the worst single country cholera epidemic in modern times. As you mentioned, the official numbers are about 9,000 killed, but studies show that it's much higher than that, probably three or more times higher. And from the very beginning, Haitians were pointing the finger at the UN, and the evidence to justify that kept mounting. First, it was clear that the epidemic started a few hundred yards downstream of the UN base, and then there was microbiological and then genetic evidence showing that the strain that was getting into Haitians' bodies, the strain of cholera, was the exact same strain that was in Nepal. And it got into the rivers because the peacekeeping base was dumping its sewage directly into the top of Haiti's largest river system. And there had recently been a rotation of troops as part of the UN peacekeeping force that came from Nepal, where they had a cholera epidemic. And when they got there, the waste from the camp continued to go into the river, and that's how cholera got to Haiti.
Well, and then, as you said, Haitians were actually demonstrating back in November. Now, this is on top of an earthquake happening. Then we've got, you know, that happened in January. And now we're, flash forward to November of 2010, cholera is introduced by Nepalese troops. Haitians in Haiti's second largest city, Cap-Haïtien, were actually protesting and saying the UN was responsible. The then head of the UN mission, or representative of the UN mission at that time, was a man named Edmond Mulet, who is a Guatemalan working with the United Nations, and he denied it. He denied it. Not only that, but his troops opened fire and killed several protesters in Cap-Haïtien. Isn't that true?
That's true, and that is not, that was not a great deviation from UN practice. I mean, throughout the UN's time in Haiti, it has had a record of shooting at protesters and people it considers to be dissidents.
And of course, they covered it up in respect. And I only bring this up because I think it's important to recognize that Haitians knew the truth then, and many of them died trying to tell the truth, shot by UN troops. And then the insult to injury was that Edmond Mulet, this representative of the United Nations in Haiti, then said that they were just gang members. And, of course, that's also part of the UN MO, hasn't it been?
Correct. That's when Haitians have a proverb that if you want to kill a dog, you say it's rabid. And that's really what the UN does, is they call people gang members, and that allows them to be shot with impunity. But it's also part of a broader effort of denigrating and devaluing Haitian lives, because with the cholera epidemic, one of the things that Mulet and his colleagues at the UN kept doing was blaming the victims, saying cholera is there because Haitians don't have good sanitation, they have cultural practices, things like that. Cultural practices that for several centuries had kept them from getting cholera, but did not keep them from getting cholera once the UN started by pumping its waste into the rivers.
Well, it sounds like that racist argument, right, which is they're black, slovenly, and they're dirty.
It's pretty hard to explain UN policy, as with U.S. policy, to Haiti without reference to racism. It's also for his service in Haiti, Mr. Mulet was actually promoted. He's now the chef de cabinet, or the chief of staff of Secretary General Ban Ki-moon.
Unbelievable. I just want to get this straight. So Edmond Mulet, who represented the UN when cholera was introduced to Haiti, who denied it, who suppressed it, who had protesters shot in Cap-Haïtien, his troops, I'm not saying he directly ordered it, but the troops under the UN directly shot at and killed Haitians who were protesting the UN having introduced cholera to their country. And then Edmond Mulet, who covered it up by lying and saying that those same protesters were gang members, has now been rewarded by being appointed the chief of staff of the current head of the United Nations, Ban Ki-moon?
Correct, which obviously makes it difficult for the UN to deny that Mr. Mulet was doing exactly what he was supposed to do.
Unbelievable, Brian. absolutely unbelievable. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and that's the voice of our guest, Brian Kincannon. He is with the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti. We're discussing how the United Nations introduced cholera to Haiti and covered it up. And I also want to talk about the civil suit that you filed on behalf of the victims in order to break through this code of silence. And I imagine it's not just the United Nations, but the United Nations had tremendous support from a lot of actors on the ground as well. I know that Oxfam at one point had said, as well as the Clinton Foundation had said, that protests aimed at the United Nations in Haiti against cholera were hampering relief efforts from the earthquake relief efforts. I know that the United States government gave them their tacit support as well when it came to denying cholera. Is that true?
Yes. So the U.S. government, including the Center for Disease Control, much has come up about what they knew, and they knew fairly early on that the UN, that the signs were pointing to the UN, but the U.S. government was active in keeping that information from going out, misleading journalists, not disclosing important information, and supporting the general line that was saying that the cause of this disease is not important, which is, of course, nonsensical. I mean, if from a public health perspective you have diseases killing hundreds of people, of course you want to find out how it got there. And that would help in the controlling efforts. And the fact that the UN, with a lot of help, was suppressing that information, that ended up making the epidemic worse, and it countered efforts to contain it. One of the things that happened was that the epidemic was centered, and as it went down the river, got into this rice area where a lot of people, there were a lot of migrant laborers there working in the rice harvest. And when people started getting sick, and then you had the UN lying about it, and everybody knowing the UN lying about it, a lot of people panicked for very good reason. And they ran up to their home villages that were up in the mountains and all throughout Haiti, and they took the cholera with them. Had the UN right from the beginning said, okay, this is a cholera epidemic, it's the same cholera epidemic we have in Nepal, and it set up centers for treatment, it's possible they could have stopped the countrywide transmission before it got too big to stop.
So, in fact, the UN attempting to cover up them having brought cholera to Haiti in the first place, this strain of cholera from Nepalese troops that were stationed there, in fact, contributed to, you're saying, the deaths of thousands more as a result.
Very likely. And that's what some of the public health people are saying, that a better response, better information and a better response could have saved a million of the lives, perhaps up to thousands.
Now, why file a suit in the United States? And what jurisdiction does a United States court have when it comes to making claims, civil claims, on behalf of those cholera victims against the United Nations?
When the cholera outbreak happened, a lot of people, again, the Haitians right from the beginning were pointing their fingers at the UN. And a lot of people came to our colleagues in Haiti and said, look, someone's going to have to file a lawsuit against the UN. They're never going to respond fairly. I actually opposed that within the organization. I said, look, the evidence is so clear. The UN's going to respond once that they can't deny this. It's just undeniable. And perhaps I was tainted a little bit. I had worked. I was a UN volunteer in Haiti for several years, for a year and a half in the 1990s. And I just felt that the UN had to accept responsibility. But 6 months into the epidemic, when it was clear that the UN was lying about its responsibility, I lost the internal arguments, and we said, okay, we've got to step up. And we initially filed complaints with the UN because the UN does have immunity. Immunity, though, is not impunity. Impunity means you can do whatever you want and you get away with it and no one can do anything about it. Immunity is a two-way street. You get protection from national courts, and there's good reasons why the UN gets protection from national courts, so they're not harassed and they're able to carry out their duties. But in return for that very extraordinary grant of protection, the UN undertakes the obligation to provide an alternate mechanism for justice. They can set up arbitration panels. They have a claims unit, which almost every day the UN is accepting claims on car accidents and things like that. So we said to the UN, okay, you've got immunity. We can't sue you in Haiti. but you do have this obligation. Here are complaints, and we file complaints on behalf of 5,000 victims. The UN took 15 months to study that and sent back a two-page letter that really had two sentences that were operative, saying that they were not going to, that our complaints were not receivable because they involved the policies of the UN. Now, that's a legal justification that has never been found anywhere, either before or since. UN human rights experts have said there is no legal justification there. And when we got that letter back, we told the UN, this is not a legal justification. If you do not sit down and talk with us or accept our complaints, you have forfeited your immunity, so we're going to go into a national court. The UN sent another letter saying we're still not going to receive your complaints and not meet with you. So we filed in the U.S. courts. And where we got jurisdiction, the jurisdiction was based on the UN being in New York. We filed in New York. And we also had some of the plaintiffs were U.S. residents who had either gotten cholera themselves or lost a very close family member and were executors of the estate. But it was a class action lawsuit with the putative class being everybody who got cholera. We filed it on behalf of five named plaintiffs. And when we filed, the UN did not respond, still has not responded to the court. But what it did do, the UN wrote to the U.S. mission to the UN, so the State Department, saying, make this case go away, because it deals with our immunity. And the U.S. government has been the carrying the U.N.'s water on this case. The U.S. government asked the judge to dismiss the case. The trial judge originally did dismiss it in January of 2015 on the grounds of immunity. We appealed. We got support from all over the world. We had 86 different organizations or prominent scholars sign a total of six briefs supporting the case. We had former UN officials, international law scholars, constitutional law scholars, human rights groups, Haitian Americans. We had a very broad range of people supporting us. The appeals court, though, just last Thursday announced that it was rejecting the appeal. And so now, in terms of procedure, we have 90 days to decide whether we're going to appeal to the Supreme Court or not. We're in the process of studying the appeal and trying to figure out what our options are legally. We've also, the UN has said that it's going to give details on how it's going to respond within 2 months. So we're going to look and see if the UN's response is something that is a serious effort to respect the victims' rights, or if it's just a bit of window dressing. And so we'll make the decision in 90 days as to whether we're going to appeal. But we're certainly not going to stop the legal cases until the UN respects the victims' rights. If we don't file with the Supreme Court, we might file in Haiti. There's several countries in Europe we're looking at filing. We're going to keep this battle going until the cholera victims get justice.
And that's the voice of my guest, Brian Kincannon. He's director of the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti. We're discussing how the United Nations brought cholera to Haiti, how they tried to cover it up, and how they have since tried to stall the case of thousands of victims. More than 9,000 people are reported to have died of cholera in Haiti. The figures, as Brian has said, are probably, most likely, far greater. Brian, well, it's interesting because really this all derives from the original sin. Now, the cholera, this is such an extremely important case because it also goes to the root of sovereignty, the issue of sovereignty. And really, Haiti lost its sovereignty after the original sin, if we want to call it that, which was the 2004 coup against the democratically elected government of Aristide. And that's really how and why the United Nations ended up being there in the first place.
That's correct. And you have a UN mission that has been unclear in terms of what it's doing. I mean, what it's doing in functional terms, it was installed to consolidate the coup d'etat 2004. And since then, it's maintained there in order to continue to consolidate, to make sure that progressive politicians in Haiti are not given the opportunity to be elected. The cholera case, as you mentioned, is a classic sign of this loss of sovereignty for a couple reasons. First of all, the mayor of the town where this waste was being dumped into the river had been complaining about it, but he didn't control his town. The UN did. Since the epidemic has come out, it's killed somewhere between 10 and 30,000 Haitians, a lot of people. That's in a country about the size of New York City. So imagine that if you had 10 to 30,000 people killed in New York City, how irate the leaders of New York would be. In Haiti, no president has ever blamed the UN for bringing the cholera, and none of them have ever called for UN compensation. And that's not because they didn't want to, that they didn't believe that the UN was responsible. There's no scientific debate about whether the UN's responsible. That's settled. It's just that because the Haitian presidents have not been exercising significant authority within their country, they felt they had no choice, that they had to do what the UN said, which meant refuse to doubt about having 30,000 of your constituents killed.
Well, and they were rewarded accordingly too. I mean, the UN has certainly turned a blind eye to the corruption that existed under the Martelly government.
Yeah, and especially Martelly was installed by Secretary of State Clinton, not elected by the Haitian people. And he, one of the reasons why he was installed was that they felt he would be reliable because he didn't have political backing, and so because he didn't have popular support, he would be subject to international influence, and that, of course, that part was very successful, and he didn't have it. You're seeing under the current government, which is an interim government and was worked out by a deal, so still not constitutional, but it does have a little bit more of a popular basis, and the government is trying to speak out a little bit more. Last week, the health minister made some very strong statements about how victim compensation was essential, and she's looking forward to working with the UN on that. But we are deeply concerned. We've heard from several sources that the UN, in anticipation of some of the developments of the last week, that the UN has been sending delegations down to Haiti to negotiate some kind of a deal. And our concern, based on the last 6 years of UN dealings, is that they're going to try to force government officials to agree to some kind of a compromise that falls far short of justice for the victims. But then the UN can say, oh, this is okay because it was approved by the Haitian government officials. And so people in Haiti are concerned about that. Advocates on the United States are as well. And it's certainly something to watch as we go forward.
Well, and as you said, you're going to decide now whether to take this case to the Supreme Court. What about the international court? What about doesn't the OAS at the regional level also have, I think it's called the IOC, that you can also appeal on behalf of the victims?
So the international justice system, I mean, if you look at the system's principles, you would say, of course, there has to be a place where this claim can be taken. If you look at the fine print, unfortunately, there isn't anywhere. And it's just like it's hard to bring a case against the United States for its human rights and legal violations in Iraq and Afghanistan and many other places. The people who set up these kind of tribunals don't want to be accountable. And the UN and its supporters, especially the United States, are key players in establishing international mechanisms. And just as you can't go to the Inter-American Commission to complain about, you can go to complain, but they can't issue binding judgments on the U.S., you also can't bring the U.N. before it's called the Inter-American Court of Human Rights, which is set up under the Organization of American
States. That's right. That's right.
So we really have no international instance that we can get to. So we're looking at national courts, beyond the U.S. courts. There's many European courts have been much more willing to deny an organization's immunity if they don't provide an alternate mechanism. We think that there might be opportunities under Haitian courts. We didn't, when we filed this case in the U.S. 3 years ago, we didn't file in Haiti because at the time you had a government that was on the record of as denying the U.N. was responsible for cholera. And you also have the U.N. Having a disproportionate influence on the Haitian government, including the justice system. That's changing, and that especially could change with the upcoming elections in October. And if Haiti moves more towards sovereignty and democracy, well, there'll be opportunities to pursue cases in Haitian courts as well.
Listening to the best of Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We close today's program with the latest episode in our weekly series, the Flashpoints Election Crimes Bulletin, with best-selling author and investigative journalist Greg Palast.
I'm really rich. I'll show you that next
time. You know, I get accused of being kind of moderate and center. I plead guilty.
You do not. Congress does not regulate Wall Street. Wall Street regulates Congress.
And you're listening to our weekly Election Crimes Bulletin with best-selling author, investigative reporter Greg Palast. Every week, Greg joins us to try and help you fight for your fair and free vote, insulate you from the various schemes that are being cooked up to undermine your ability to vote. And our good brother Greg Palast has a major film that is going to be released this week. He's got an article that just went up by Rolling Stone, the GOP's secret war against voters. Will an anti-voter fraud program designed by one of Trump's advisors deny tens of thousands their right to vote in November? Greg Palast, welcome back to our special bulletin, and it's getting exciting. Film coming up, and the battle continues for the right to vote.
Yes, Dennis. The film, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, A Tale of Billionaires and Ballot Bandits, will be out soon. In fact, by coincidence, Dennis Bernstein and I, with comedian Will Durst, will be premiering it in the Bay Area on September 7th at the Grand Lake Theater as a fundraiser for KPFA. And go to kpfa.org to get the tickets. I don't get a dime out of this, but what I do get is the wonderful KPFA, your weapon of mass instruction in the Bay Area. Now, this week, go to it, pick it up, Rolling Stone has a tremendous investigative report. I know about it because I wrote it. The GOP's secret war against voters. This is an investigation I've now been on. I say 1 year in the article, but it's really been 2.5 years. Uncovering a system by which the GOP has already removed tens of thousands, probably hundreds of thousands of voters from the voter rolls. And it's probably going to hit a million, Dennis, by November.
Incredibly important. And this is where we really came in the door with this series and talking about a guy by the name of Chris Kobach, who is
yes.
At the core of this attempt to call it the 21st century version of Jim Crow, the electronic Jim Crow. Talk a
yes.
little bit about, set this up, Greg. Well, we're excited. The Rolling Stone put it up today. We're happy to have you on. Lay this out. Give us a bit of a thumbnail sketch.
Okay. Here's the deal. 29 Republican secretaries of state have given their voter rolls over to the Republican Secretary of State of Kansas. He's a right-winger who is just slapped down by the Supreme Court for his racially biased voting tricks. And now he has every Republican state's voter rolls, including the swing states of Ohio and North Carolina and Arizona. Now, what's he doing with these? He is cross-checking the list. What does that mean? He has a system called cross-check where he's looking for people who are voting in two states at once. So he says, for example, and this is a real example, Maria Cristina Hernandez, he says, has voted in Virginia. And she's also voted in Georgia, which is, by the way, I want to warn Maria Hernandez, that's a go-to-jail five-year felony crime to vote twice. Except in Georgia, she's voting as Maria Isabel Hernandez. So it's Maria Cristina Hernandez, supposed to be the same voter as Maria Isabel Hernandez. Now, believe it or not, the people in Kansas and this Chris Kobach, who, by the way, is the guy who he just told me, I just spoke to him, he did devise the plan for Donald Trump to force Mexico to pay for his wall, okay? But according to Kobach, Maria Hernandez is not a common name, at least not common for Republicans. And so he can't imagine why those are two different people, Maria Cristina Hernandez, Maria Isabel Hernandez. That's not an odd example. In his, now, here's the thing.
Other than they have different names.
Yeah, they have different names, right? So, but, you know, I'm laughing, but
here's the problem.
He can't
distinguish you, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. So both Maria Hernandez's, both Maria Cristina and Maria Isabel lose their votes. They stand a chance of losing their votes. Both. Now, here's how the gimmick works. Here's the problem. And here's how I found out. Why hasn't this story been all over the press before? Because the answer is Kobach, this right winger, Trump's operative. And he's, by the way, he's mostly doing this for the GOP. He's not doing it just for Trump. These are close Senate races in these states. The reason it hasn't been public is because no one's gotten the list. And in fact, as far as I know, I'm the only journalist who asked for the list, and they told me flat out you can't get them. Because think about it, Dennis, if you vote twice, that's committing a felony crime. So these are lists of the criminal suspects, which of course are police confidential. The thing is, you know how many people are on the suspect list? 7 million, 7.2 million people. Now, I wasn't supposed to get the list, but, you know, Greg Pallas, if you know me, I do investigative reporting. That means we know is not an answer we appreciate. Know is where we begin. And when they said it's confidential, we worked until we got the first list, which is out of Virginia, which immediately sent us a letter saying, we sent you this list by mistake, and 1 year I may give it back to them. I don't have to give back a list, which to me is evidence of criminality. What's
okay,
the criminality?
Okay, yeah.
The way people
now,
votes.
Back up. Tell us what who is on these lists? How do they come about? Who controls them? These lists.
Let me make it simple. It's a list where Kobach takes the list of 29 states voter lists, compares the names, and when he finds two names that are the same, those people are put on the cross-check list sent back to their state, and they then are reviewed to have their vote taken away. Their vote can be taken away. Now, not everyone on the list will have their vote taken away. They make it a little complex process, frankly, to hide their steps. And so here's how it works. So, for example, they said publicly, now, obviously, there's a lot of Maria Hernandezes in this country and a lot of David Lees, who are almost all Asian American, and David Kims, and a lot of people, by the way, named Mohammed, the most common name on the planet. And they claimed publicly, because they have announced the program publicly, that they checked the first name, middle name, last name, junior, senior, address history, social security number, date of birth. They've got to get the right guys. But in fact, when we got the instructions, it said if the social security numbers don't match, and by the way, roughly none of them do out of 7 million.
Roughly none.
roughly none. If they don't match, don't worry about it. So, yes, they have the information. They ignore it. The middle name mismatches out of 7 million names they've collected, 2 million pairs. 2 million names are mismatched by middle name. 2 million of the voters are mismatched by middle name. We have several hundred thousand which are mismatched junior, senior, third. In other words, they have listed fathers and sons as the same person, the same voter, illegally voting twice or registering twice. Both lose their vote. Now, what is so dangerous about this? And why would Republicans be doing this? Do Republicans have something against people with common names? Here's the trick. As the U.S. Census shows, and this is where I got into my own background in statistics and brought in a whole team of experts who do the database management for eBay and for American Express, et cetera. And they were horrified because they said, this is just a list of first and last name matches. It's childish. It's dangerous. And then they did a statistical run and said, and it's racially biased, massively racially biased, because 85 out of the 100 most common names in America, 85 are overweighted with minorities, Black Americans, Hispanic Americans, Asian Americans, who, by the way, vote nearly as Democratic as Black Americans. People don't realize that. I mean, they were 74%. It's looking like over 80% of Asian Americans are going to vote Democratic this year. So you have a lot of people, and like name Mohammed Mohammed. You've got a lot of people named yes, there are a few white names like John Smith, but even the names like Smith, like the actor, the African American actor, Will Smith. I mean, it's a very common name. So even the white names are substantially Black, but the Black names and the Hispanic names like Garcia, for example, is 94% Hispanic. It always puzzles me, who are the other 6% of Garcias who aren't Hispanic? But that's a minor point.
You know, there are five Dennis Bernsteins. At least three of them are writers. Actually, one of them is down there with the UNLA. He writes on hockey. I guess all the Dennis Bernsteins.
Yes, five. And there's another ethnic group, by the way. The Jewish population, you have a lot of Levies. And so what happens is, and you have a lot of ethnic groups where they're not in the top 100. They're very small, but like, for example, a lot of Nepali Tibetans have the last name Sherpa. A lot of Indians are named Singh. So they're named Singh. And so you have these commonalities in ethnic names, which are Democrats, which you don't have in like, for example, Chris Kobach. There's one. Charles Koch. There's two. I looked it up. David Koch, there's three. That's it. And it's very – and they, believe me, they're not on these lists. And so what's happening is you end up with basically a hit list of ethnics. And what they do is – now, they got a list of 7 million dentists. They're not removing all 7 million. There's another way that they bias – there's two ways that they bias the program. Okay, it's already racially poisonous, the list. On top of this, they send out postcards – to people that look like junk mail. Now, the junk mail experts we spoke to said this is the worst. This postcard is meant not to be returned. It's like inscrutable small print, doesn't mean anything. It doesn't even say you're accused of voting twice. It just says please confirm your voting address. Now most people say, well, it's confirmed. You just mailed this to me, schmuck. So people throw it away. But which people throw it away? According to the experts, that the chance that someone under 25 throwing away their card, in other words, likely to vote Democratic, likely to throw away a card, is 900% higher than someone over 65. White people respond to government threatening notices twice as at twice the rate of African Americans and Hispanics. So you have an ethnic difference. You have an age difference, all, again, prejudicing towards the Republican voter. And then here's – so that if a few Republicans get caught, they're probably elderly white suburbanites who will return their card and save their vote. Now, here's the other trick. As our experts told us, the post office doesn't like to tell you this, but they don't deliver a lot – they don't deliver all the mail in low-income areas. You just don't get it. Or if it's in a building with a bunch of boxes, they don't care which box they put it in. People who have low incomes, the unemployed and young people like students, are, you know, move around. So they don't, they may be legal voters, but they're not at their mailing address when these cards come in. Like students who are legally registered get these cards in the summer, and they've lost their chance to vote. And you don't know you've lost your chance to vote until you either show up and find out. They don't even tell you, oh, you're listed as a double voter. They say you're inactive, whatever that means. Sorry, you can't vote. So it is, we do know. They won't tell us. Like I say, they were hiding the names from us. I got 2 million of the 7 million names anyway. They will not tell us the names of the people they've actually finally removed, though Virginia told us that they had they eliminated 41,000 people already.
41,000. 41,000.
And listen to this. Chris Kobach, who came up with the system, when I said, look at your list that you sent to Virginia. These aren't matches. They're different people, different middle names. He says, oh, well, first he said that those names weren't on the list. And I said, sorry, but we got this list from your computer. Try again. Yes, the other day when I told him Rolling Stone was rolling with this, he said, he called me up, actually, and said, yeah, that's our list. And he said, but people don't have to use the list. I said, Virginia used your list. 41,000 names were removed. He said, they can't have removed them. That's like a violation of federal law. He said that. He's a law professor, right? And because he told them they have to go through a procedure, and they said, ah, skip it. This isn't write the names off.
Really? So,
and that's what most states are doing. They're not going through some fancy procedure. They're just writing the names off.
Right.
And even if they go through a fancy procedure, these are not double voters. This is just a racist cull. This is just like what happened when I caught Catherine Harris removing black men from the voter rolls as felons because Will Smith in Florida, who's an innocent voter, some guy 50 years ago in Ohio committed a felony crime with the same name. And that was it. That's the only connection.
All right. Okay, that's the voice of Greg Palast. His article just on the Rolling Stone website right as we speak, the GOP's secret war against voters. He is covering the 2016 election for Rolling Stone, and this is a very important piece that we are talking about. It's been a theme in this weekly series we've been doing for you, the Election Crimes Bulletin. There is a film. It is going to be premiering, doing its Bay Area premiere on September 7th. We're proud here to be a part of it. And Greg, say a little bit more about the film. We're all pretty excited.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because it's a first of all, it is the actual filming of this investigation for Rolling Stone, where I hunt down the lists, get the lists. I actually go to Ohio and North Carolina, and I meet these criminal double voters, including one. There's a guy who votes as a woman named Willie. He's on the list as supposedly one person votes as Willie Mae Nelson, and then also votes as Willie H. Nelson in another state. And so I confronted this evil double voter, Willie Mae Nelson. And it's true, he has pigtails. So I asked him if that's how he got away with being a woman, but I didn't see how he got away with the beard. And so that's why I asked him, are you – so, you know, he kept –
Did he also sing
really
a song or
– Yeah, he does. But he sang We Shall Overcome for me. And you'll see that plays in – that's an important part of the film. What's happening is I not only go after, and then I go jump this guy, Chris Kobach, who is the, who's the Secretary of State of Kansas, Trump's boy, who is running this purge program called CrossCheck. And he refused to meet with me. So I actually showed up at a park with a camera crew, and I had one of those fat microphones with a little cube on it where I had the number 4. Custom made, so I looked like a local Channel 4 camera crew and got through to him. It wasn't completely a deception because Rolling Stone wouldn't let me do this, but Channel 4 of London, England wanted the footage, so it was quite honest.
So it was for
true.
Channel.
And I grabbed him, and then of
the
course.
All the Channel 4s of the world. Beware.
And so I grabbed his hand and started congratulating him on his vote fraud hunting. Cross-check system, and he was smiling, and then he looks up and realizes, uh-oh, Greg Palast. And he tries to get away with me, but I wouldn't let go of his hand. And the only way he got out of it is we had to stand up for the Pledge of Allegiance. We do this in the film. We say the Pledge of Allegiance. Mm-hmm. And then he tries to run away with me, but it's an ice cream social. And by the way, for the Republicans, only vanilla, no chocolate. I'm not kidding. And he's trying to eat his ice cream and run away from me.
No.
Call me
you
a liar.
Are kidding. You are kidding.
At the same
not
time.
Only vanilla.
This is all in the film. Oh, it, only vanilla. And he's trying to run away, eat his vanilla ice cream, yelling at me, I'm a liar. And then there's kind of an elder riot of these old Republicans grabbing at my fedora and my list, et cetera. And then I go on the hunt. Who's behind him? And, of course, I mean, I'm not giving away much because there's so much going on here. We have cartoons. The guy who did Who Framed Roger Rabbit did cartoons for us. So I do go back to the old story of the felon purge in Florida, but it's done as a Saturday morning cartoon with that dangerous duo, Catherine and Jeb. And that's a good cartoon. Then I also go hunt down the billionaires behind these scams, including, for example, JP, John Paulson, the foreclosure king, the guy we talked about in prior flashpoints and prior election crimes bulletins as the real billionaire behind Donald Trump. And I have, but to understand how this guy made his billions, which was by crashing the mortgage market. In other words, he didn't just bet against the mortgage market in 2008. He kicked it over a cliff and I'm telling you, he escaped jail by nothing more. And I've taken him on this. By hiring the former chairman of the SEC for over $10 million to protect him, to keep him out of prison. And he walked away clean with $5 billion personally, not his company. His company made $14
billion. Listen,
we have this guy. Yeah, I jumped this guy. And I jumped this guy in the film, and you'll see it. It wasn't easy. We had to sneak into a $1,000 a plate dinner, and which we did by looking like other rich people showed up at his Hampton's place in our very cool James Bondy speedboat that I have.
Literally in a boat with a tuxedo? Come on.
The whole nine yards.
All
and,
right.
And
well,
but remember, a hat with I just got to tell you one other thing. I had a hat with a hidden camera in it.
So, all right. So, listen, Mr. Palast, pleasure every week. Film coming up in the Bay Area September 7th. More at GregPalast.com. People can hear these bulletins at Greg Palast or also at flashpoints.net, KPFA.org. We are delighted to do this with you, Greg. We'll talk soon. Stay tuned.
I'm really rich. I'll show you that in a second.
You know, I get accused of being kind of moderate and center. I plead guilty.
You do not. Congress does not regulate Wall Street. Wall Street regulates Congress.
Wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Our senior producer is Miguel Gavilan Molina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. Our guest host and senior producer is Kevin Pina. Special thanks to our interns Jordy Sanchez and Zach Lander. For more information about the show, to listen to or download archived episodes, log on to flashpoints.net or visit our SoundCloud page at soundcloud.com/flashpoints. For questions or comments about Flashpoints, you can email Dennis at dennisjbernstein@gmail.com. Thank you for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
New World Notes.
That is what the establishment in this political moment fear the most. They fear that we will step outside that system of managed democracy, that political theater, and find our own voice and our own power. And they're frightened. And they will work very, very hard to sell you once again the mantra of the least worst. But look at our own history. Every time we vote for the least worst, it gets worse. It doesn't work.
That was Chris Hedges with some wise thoughts on the phony elections now being staged by the rulers of our managed democracy. Those are strong words, and I wouldn't have said them 10 years ago. Chris Hedges would have, and did. And he'll say it again this week in part two of his recent speech in Seattle, The Algebra of Revolution. This is Kenneth Doust, and I welcome you to New World Notes. This is the 12th presidential election in which I am eligible to vote. Once again, the establishment is urging me to hold my nose and vote for the less terrible of the two right-wing, warmongering big party candidates. Thanks, but no thanks. I did that the first 7 times, and I quit doing that at the end of the 20th century. I'm not advising what you should do this November, so I'll just end with the words of that great moral philosopher, Jiminy Cricket. Let your conscience be your guide. Chris Hedges is a pretty good moral philosopher, too. He was the son of a Christian minister, Presbyterian, I think, a minister whose career suffered when he stood up for just but unpopular causes. For instance, gay rights before that became popular. Son Chris was educated at the best schools, on scholarship, of course, including Harvard Divinity School. After he received his Master of Divinity degree, he became an overseas war correspondent for the New York Times. So he's read a lot and observed a lot and thought a lot about both. Like his father, Chris has been willing to fight for what's right as he sees it, and he's got the arrest record to prove it. Some of this he talks about in today's installment. Let us return to Chris Hedges and The Algebra of Revolution.
Alexander Berkman wrote an essay called The Idea is the Thing, which I use a little bit of in the new book. He writes that when a ruling class, when its ideology loses its credibility, whether that's the divine right of kings or Luther challenging the hegemony of the Catholic Church, the superstructure or the facade of power remains in place. But you begin a process of ferment. He likens it to water boiling in a kettle. So that at the end, you see the steam and you hear the whistle, but you've not watched that process of ferment. And I think that's what we're seeing now within this election campaign. This deep frustration, and I would say it is a frustration which people have every right to, being expressed against a closed political establishment. Now, the Democratic Party, it looks, has successfully locked out Sanders. within the Republican Party. If Trump does not get that first ballot, it appears that they are quite willing to disembowel themselves to prevent him from getting the nomination. And my criticism of Sanders from the beginning, and it's something that I have spoken to him about, is that he tried to run within the confines of the Democratic Party. And his argument, and he wasn't incorrect, was that if he ran as an independent, he would end up like Nader. And he's right. If he challenged the Democratic Party in a meaningful way, the Democratic Party would use their considerable resources to turn him into a pariah, as Dennis Kucinich was, within the Congress, to mount a serious challenge against him in terms of a Senate seat in Vermont. And he did not want to be pushed into the political wilderness. Of course, the corporate media, which hasn't been very good to him anyway, would shut him out. So he was correct in that he would not suffer the retribution of the party and he would have a platform. But my fear is that at a certain moment, because he's within that structure, he is going to take the enthusiasm and the energy and attempt to direct it towards the Clinton campaign. And at that point, he becomes an impediment to everything we must build. We are not going to build a movement outside of the formal structures of power in an election cycle. Syriza started polling at 4% 10 years later, they took power in Greece. And that's how we have to begin to think, to free ourselves from the highs and lows of American culture. We have to stand fast around these moral imperatives. We have to begin to build a movement by which power is frightened of us. Carl Polanyi, in The Open Society and Its Enemies, he says, the question is not how do you get good people to rule. Most people, Polanyi writes, who are attracted to power are at best mediocre and usually venal. The question is how do you make the powerful frightened of you? So as Ralph points out, our last liberal president was Richard Nixon. Not because he was a liberal or had a conscience, but because he was frightened of movements. I saw that for the book Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt, I was down in West Virginia with a guy named Ken Heckler, who was in Congress, and unlike the current politicians from West Virginia, didn't work for the coal companies. And he authored and got on Nixon's desk the black lung compensation legislation. And Nixon didn't want to sign it. And Heckler told me he got up and held a press conference and said, if the president doesn't sign it, there will be a nationwide coal strike tomorrow, and this country will be thrown into an energy crisis. And Nixon signed it that night. And Heckler said, I didn't really know if there was going to be a... That's how power works. There's a scene in Kissinger's memoirs, do not buy the book, and Nixon has taken empty city buses end-to-end around the White House, and there's tens of thousands of anti-war demonstrators, and Nixon's wringing his hands, looking out the window, going, Henry, they're going to break through the barricades and get us. And that's just where we want people in power to be. That's our job as citizens. And the job of corporate politicians, and I'm going to have to include Obama, is to deliver credulous voters before the altar of corporate power. And Ron Suskind, his book Confidence Men, which is the inside story of the Obama collusion with Wall Street, points this out, that Obama meets with the CEOs of Wall Street, Susskind reports, early on in his presidency, and says the only thing between you and the pitchforks is me. And in the book, at one point, Susskind's interviewing a corporate executive and asks him why they keep criticizing Obama when Obama gives them everything they want. And they say, oh, no, no, we have to keep criticizing him because that's how we keep him off balance so that he'll always give us what we want. The fact that we have allowed Wall Street to build a financial system that, in essence, counts debt as income, that has created a mechanism where they borrow money at virtually 0% interest, and then, especially if we're late on our credit cards, loans it back to us at 28% interest. I don't think that's capitalism. I don't know what it is, extortion. But it's not a sustainable system. Michael Hudson, in his new book, writes that there have been societies, including the end of the Roman Empire, where speculators have seized power. But he said what's unique about neoliberalism or globalization is that we're the first society who actually argues that debt is a form of wealth creation. And you have created a parasitic class that in essence is making its money by throwing larger and larger sections of the population into debt peonage, and in particular, students. There's a reason wages don't rise. There's a reason college tuitions continue to skyrocket. And courtesy of this Congress, students who borrow money will eventually pay more interest than if they'd taken it from a bank. And debt peonage, of course, is always a form of social control, as any African American understands. And so we stand at the moment facing some deep, frightening forces. We have watched our capitalist democracy be transformed, largely through the courts, into what the philosopher Sheldon Wolin calls inverted totalitarianism. And by that, he means it's not classical totalitarianism. It doesn't find its expression through a demagogue or a charismatic leader, but through the anonymity of the corporate state. And that in a classical totalitarian regime, you have a party that creates new symbols, new vocabulary, new mechanisms of control. In inverted totalitarianism, you have corporate forces that purport to pay fealty to the Constitution, the iconography and language of American patriotism, electoral politics, and yet internally have seized the levers of power to render the citizen impotent. It's a faceless system, as Hannah Arendt writes in Origins of Totalitarianism. And the courts are used to strip us of our rights by reinterpreting our constitutional guarantees so that Citizens United becomes a way to petition the government or a form of free speech. All of the challenges, the legal challenges that we have made since the Snowden revelations have come to naught. And we are the most watched, photographed, monitored, eavesdropped population in human history. And when the government watches you 24 hours a day, you cannot use the word liberty. That is the relationship between a master and a slave. And the government knows what's coming. They have run scenario after scenario. The militarization of police forces, Section 1021 of the National Defense Authorization Act, which, as you heard, I sued Obama in federal court over. This was a section that overturned the 1878 Posse Comitatus Act, which prohibited the military from serving as a domestic police force. It was a seismic moment in American history and went virtually uncovered, with the exception of my old employer, the New York Times. who not only covered the trial, but when Judge Catherine B. Forrest ruled in our favor, wrote an editorial praising her decision. But it didn't appear on MSNBC, because it didn't make Obama look good. And it didn't appear on Fox, because it didn't make the Republicans look good. And that section within the NDAA, which is renewed every year, in essence, allows the government to carry out acts of extraordinary rendition on the streets of American cities to seize U.S. citizens deemed to be terrorists, hold them indefinitely in military facilities, and strip them of due process. And Judge Forrest, in her 112-page opinion, wrote that this, in essence, gives the government the ability to criminalize an entire category of people and strip them of their rights. And she brought up the 110,000 Japanese Americans who were interned in World War II. And it was instructive of the failure of our court system, not just to defend the rights of citizens, but the Constitution itself, that her ruling created a terrible dilemma. The Obama administration appealed. They didn't just appeal. They appeared at her chambers the day she issued a temporary injunction invalidating that law. And they said, you must put it back into effect immediately in the name of national security. And instead of the federal attorneys, they now had attorneys from the NSA. And Judge Forrest, to her credit, refused. That was a Friday. 9 a.m. Monday morning, they were in the Second Circuit Appellate Court making the same request, and unfortunately, the Appellate Court agreed. Why? Why? We knew they'd appeal. And the only assumption that the attorneys and I could make was that they're already using the law, that there are most probably U.S. Pakistani dual nationals in black sites somewhere. And if that injunction was allowed to stand, if they got out, they could hold the government in contempt of court. Now, what did the Second Circuit do? And this was a window, or is a window, into how our judicial system has become a wholly owned subsidiary of the corporate state. They held the hearing, and then they wouldn't rule for months. And they waited. I was a plaintiff before the Supreme Court. This was before the Snowden revelations, in a case called Clapper versus Amnesty International, where I and other journalists had challenged the government on wholesale wiretapping. And the federal attorneys got up, the government attorneys at the Supreme Court, and they said, we had no right to bring this charge because the charge that the government was carrying out surveillance was, in their words, speculation. And then they added that if we were being watched by the government would tell us. And so the Supreme Court threw the case out, and the Second Circuit said, look, Hedges doesn't have standing in Clapper versus Amnesty International, therefore he doesn't have standing in Hedges versus Obama. And it became law. In case after case, and we haven't begun to talk about the system of mass incarceration, where 94% of the people in our prisons, we have, of course, 25% of the world's prison population with 5% of the world's population, 94% never go to trial. So in that sense, technically, they're innocent because they never had a chance. And as anyone who works in a prison will tell you, those who habitually have the longest sentences are those who went to trial. Because as Michelle Alexander points out, the system is not designed to provide trial by jury. It's designed to offer plea agreements. And the students that I have with the longest sentences are usually the ones who didn't commit the crime because they naively, because they were innocent, believed that they could go to a court and find justice. But what happens is that the 15 charges, because in a plea agreement they'll knock off so many, you get charged with all of them. And that's one of the reasons I teach in a prison, is because these people have no illusion about what's happened to our country. They understand power. They understand what Hannah Arendt calls omnipotent policing. She writes about it as a woman who has become stateless. She's picked up by the Gestapo, held for 3 weeks, almost killed. She almost doesn't make it out. Ends up in France without a passport. And she sees the way the French police treat people like her, who have no rights as French citizens, indeed have been stripped of their citizenship entirely. And in The Origins of Totalitarianism, she said, when you create a segment of your population that has no rights, rights become privileges. And when rights become privileges, they can be taken away. And that's exactly what's happened in our poor communities of color, where police serve as judge, jury, and executioners. Most of these trials, it's the word of the police against you. So that there is both a legal mechanism and a physical mechanism in poor communities of color that essentially allows the state to govern under what can only be described as martial law, including the indiscriminate use of lethal force against unarmed citizens. And Arendt warns that if a society devolves and there is unrest and instability, that legal and physical mechanism of omnipotent policing instantly can spread. I have children, and I'm terrified about the world that they will inherit, environmentally, politically. I was a war correspondent for 20 years. I know violence, and I hate violence. I don't believe in just war. Once you employ violence, it's a poison. And that is the focus of my book, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. I believe, as Father Daniel Berrigan says, that the essence of faith is that the good draws to it the good, at least the good insofar as we can determine it, and then we must let it go. The Buddhists call it karma. Even empirically of everything around us points to the fact that our struggles have been futile. It does not invalidate the struggle for justice. And I think that we have to recover that sense of faith, that belief that we are called to stand on the side of the oppressed, that understanding that when you join the oppressed, you will get treated like the oppressed. And I think human history has borne out that when movements hold fast to a moral imperative, they will not achieve formal positions of power, but they can begin to seismically move the society. I covered the Velvet Revolution with Vaclav Havel. I was every night in the Magic Lantern Theater with Havel and Klaus and Dinsberg. And Havel's great 1978 essay, The Power of the Powerless, makes this point. He calls it living in truth. And I think that, for those of us who care about justice, have forgotten that it is not our job to take power. It is our job to keep power in check. Let me here commend the activists in Seattle who shut down that highway. And that is what the establishment in this political moment fear the most. They fear that we will step outside that system of managed democracy, that political theater, and find our own voice and our own power. And they're frightened. And they will work very, very hard to sell you once again the mantra of the least worst. But look, Look at our own history. Every time we vote for the least worst, it gets worse. It doesn't work. Every despotic regime that falls, every revolution that succeeds, as Crane Brinton and Jeffrey Davies, the great theorists and revolution, have pointed out, succeeds when significant sectors of the foot soldiers of the elite, the civil service, the bureaucracy, the police, refuse to defend discredited centers of power. And that is why I believe they passed Section 1021 of the NDAA. They don't totally trust the police to protect them. We went to Pelosi during that two-year battle, and we said, when you renew it, all you have to do is insert into that section that this does not apply to U.S. citizens, and we will drop our lawsuit. But, of course, they did not, because it was written for U.S. citizens. The Chicago teachers march through the streets. They go to the precinct houses, and the police applaud. I was arrested in front of the White House a couple years ago with 133 others, most all of whom were veterans, protesting the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. And as they cuffed us, it turned out those police had been in the National Guard. They'd been in Iraq. They'd been in Afghanistan. And they would whisper, keep protesting. When we were arrested in front of the Congress, as we were being escorted out, one of the police officers turned and said, how do we get money out of politics? And that's why nonviolence is so important, because it is about the good drawing to it the good. And it's not easy, and I am acutely aware of the violence that police employ against the poor, and in particular poor people of color in this country. And yet, at this moment in history, those who hold power are morally bankrupt and have been exposed. And if we can recover the moral force to resist, to carry out sustained acts of civil disobedience, to create third parties outside of the system that give expression to those movements, then we can use the word hope. Thank you.
Chris Hedges, wrapping up The Algebra of Revolution. I have edited the audio for radio broadcast. The original video recording was provided by Pirate TV Seattle. Many thanks for that. And I thank you, too, for listening to New World Notes. On the web, we are at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust advising, illegitimae non carborundum, let your conscience be your guide. We are not powerless, they just want us to feel that way. And please come back again next week. Ciao.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake-up call. Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl.
If you listen to the alternative public affairs programs on this station regularly, you probably get just how controlled, complicit, corrupt, and compromised the corporate and some, quote, alternative media are. But the three speeches you'll hear on today's show will probably still shock you a little and take you a little deeper into just how controlled and fraudulent much of our information sources are. All of what you're about to hear has been lightly edited to fit within our time constraints. The first speaker is Udo Urfkat, a former German journalist and former editor of the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung. In 2014, he came out with the book Bought Journalism: How Politicians, Intelligence, and High Finance Control Germans' Mass Media. And here he is, Udo Urfkat. And this is from an interview he did on Russia Today.
I've been a journalist for about 25 years, and I was educated to lie, to betray, and not to tell the truth to the public. But seeing right now, within the last months, how the German and American media tries to bring war to the people in Europe, to bring war to Russia, this is a point of no return. And I am going to stand up and say it is not right what I have done in the past to manipulate people, to make propaganda against Russia. And it is not right what my colleagues do and have done in the past, because they are bribed to betray the people, not only in Germany, all over Europe. The reason writing this book was that I am very fearful of a new war in Europe, and I don't like to have this situation again, because war is never coming from itself. There is always people behind it to push for war. And this is not only politicians, this is journalists too. And I just have written in the book how we have betrayed in the past our readers just to push for war, because I don't want this anymore. I'm fed up with this propaganda. We live in a banana republic and not in a democratic country where we have press freedom, where we have human rights. If you see the German media, especially my colleagues who day by day write against the Russians, who are in transatlantic organizations and who are supported by the United States to do so, well, people like me, I became honorary citizen of the state of Oklahoma in the United States just because I wrote pro-American. I was supported by the Central Intelligence Agency, by the CIA. Why? Because I should be pro-American. I'm fed up with it. I don't want to do it anymore. So I've just written a book not to earn money. No, it will cause a lot of trouble for me, just to give the people in this country, in Germany, in Europe, and all over the world, just to give them a glimpse of a view what goes up behind the closed doors. There is many examples for that. If we go just back to history, if you go into the year 1988, if you go to your archives, you will find in March 1988 that there was in Iraq, the Kurdish people have been gassed with poisoned gas. That is known all over the world. But in July 1988, they sent me to a town called Zubaydat, that is on the Iraqi-Iranian border. It was war between the Iranians and the Iraqis, and I was sent there to photograph how the Iranians have been gassed with poisoned gas, with German poisoned gas. You call it lost and zarin, mustard gas, made by Germany. They have been gassed, and I was there to make photographs how these people have been killed by poisoned gas from Germany. When I came back to Germany, there was just one small photo in a newspaper, in the Frankfurter Allgemeine, and there was one small article not writing how impressive, brutally, how unhuman, how terrible it was to kill, decades after the end of the Second World War, people with German poisoned gas. So this was a situation I feel misused for having been there and just to give a documentary what has been done, but not being allowed to cry out to the world what we have done behind closed doors. Up to today, it's not well known in the public that with German public gas, there have been hundreds or thousands of people gassed in this city of Zubeda. Now, you ask, what have I done for intelligence agencies? So please see, most of the journalists you see in foreign countries, they claim to be journalists, and they might be journalists, European or American journalists, but many of them, like me in the past, are so-called non-official cover. That's what the Americans call that. I have been a non-official cover. Non-official cover means what? It means you too work for an intelligence agency. You help them if they want you to help them, but they will never, never, when they find out that you are not only a journalist, but a spy too, they will never say, oh, this was one of our guys. They will not know you. That means non-official cover. So I have helped them in several situations, and I feel ashamed for that too now. Like I feel ashamed that I have worked for very recommended newspaper like the Frankfurter Allgemeine because I was bribed by billionaires, I was bribed by the Americans not to report exactly the truth. But I just imagined in my car while I was driving to this interview, I just tried to work out in my brain what would have happened if I would have written a pro-Russian article in the Frankfurter Allgemeine. Well, I don't know what would have happened, but we were all educated to write pro-European, pro-American, but please, not pro-Russian. So I'm very sorry for that, but this is not what I understand for democracy and for press freedom. I'm very sorry for that. Germany is still a kind of a colony of the United States. You see that in many points, like the majority of the Germans don't want to have nukes in our country, but we still have American nukes. So we are still a kind of a colony of the Americans. And being a colony, it is very easy to approach young journalists through what is very important here is transatlantic organizations. All journalists from really respected and recommended big German newspapers, magazines, radio stations, TV stations, they are all members or guests of those big transatlantic organizations. And in these transatlantic organizations, you are approached to be pro-American. And there is nobody coming to you and saying, well, we are the Central Intelligence Agency. Would you like to work for us? No, this is not the case how it happens. What they do, these transatlantic organizations, is they invite you for seeing the United States. They pay for that. They pay all your expenses and everything. So you are bribed. You get more and more corrupt because they make you good contacts. You won't know that those good contacts are, let's say, non-official covers or officially people working for Central Intelligence Agency or other American agencies. So you make friends. You think they are friends and you cooperate with them. But they ask you, well, could you do me this favor? Could you do me that favor? And so your brain more and more is brainwashed through these guys. And is this only the case with German journalists? No, I think it is especially the case with British journalists, because they have a much closer relationship. It is especially the case with Israelis, of course, with French journalists for a part, not that big as with German or with British journalists. It is the case for Australian journalists, for journalists from New Zealand, from Taiwan, from, well, there is many countries, countries in the Arab world, like Jordan, for example, like Oman, the Sultanate of Oman. There is many countries where this happens, where you find people to claim they are respected journalists, but if you look behind them, you'll find they are puppets on a string of the Central Intelligence Agency. Sometimes the intelligence agencies, they come to your office and want you to write an article. I give you an example, not from strange other journalists, from me myself. I've just forgotten the year. I just remember that the German Foreign Intelligence, Bundesnachrichtendienst, it is just a sister organization of the Central Intelligence Agency. It was founded by the American Intelligence Agency. So one day, the BND, this German Foreign Intelligence Agency, came to my office at the Frankfurter Allgemeine in Frankfurt. And they wanted me to write an article about Libya and about Colonel Muammar Gaddafi. I had absolutely no secret informations regarding Colonel Muammar Gaddafi and Libya. But they gave me all these secret informations, and they just wanted me to sign the article with my name. I did that, but it was an article that was published in the Frankfurt Allgemeine that originally came from the Bundesnachrichtendienst, from the German Foreign Intelligence Agency. So do you really think that this is journalism, intelligence agencies writing articles? That article was how Libya and Colonel Muammar Gaddafi, how he secretly tried to build a poison gas factory, I think in Rabta was the name, yeah. It was a story that was printed worldwide 2 days later. But I had no information on that. It was the intelligence agency that wanted me to write this article. So, but this is not the way journalism should work, that intelligence agencies, that they decide what is printed and what not. If I say no, I give you a very good example if you say no. Well, we have a rescue unit in Germany with helicopters for traffic accidents. They call themselves the Yellow Angels. There was one guy who didn't want to cooperate. He was a pilot of the helicopter service of the Yellow Angels in Germany. This guy said no to the Foreign Intelligence Service, Bundesnachrichtendienst, when they approached him and wanted him as a non-official cover to work for the German Foreign Intelligence Agency, just to pretend to be somebody from the Yellow Angels. So what happened was that he lost his job. And the court in Germany, the judge, decided that they were right because such a guy could not be trusted. He was kicked off his job because he didn't cooperate with the Foreign Intelligence Service. So I knew what would happen if I would not cooperate with intelligence services. I have had 6 times my house was house searched because I was accused by the public prosecutor, the German public prosecutor. I was accused of leaking secrets of states. 6 times house searched. Well, they hoped that I wouldn't do that ever again. But I think it's worse that the truth will come out one day. The truth won't die. And I don't mind what will happen. I've had 3 heart attacks. I have no children. So if they want to bring me to court or to prison, so it's worse for the truth.
Next, you're going to hear former CBS News correspondent Cheryl Adkinson. She resigned from CBS in March of 2014 after 21 years. She's received many awards. One was an Emmy Award for Outstanding Investigative Journalism for her reporting on the business of Congress. And here she is giving a TED Talk called AstroTurf and Manipulation of Media Messages. And this was first published on YouTube in February of 2015.
So consider this fictitious example that's inspired by real life. Say you're watching the news and you see a story about a new study on the cholesterol-lowering drug called Cholextra. The study says Cholextra is so effective that doctors should consider prescribing it to adults and even children who don't yet have high cholesterol. Is it too good to be true? You're smart. You decide to do some of your own research. You do a Google search. You consult social media, Facebook and Twitter. You look at Wikipedia, WebMD, a nonprofit website. And you read the original study in a peer-reviewed published medical journal. It all confirms how effective Cholextra is. You do run across a few negative comments and a potential link to cancer, but you dismiss that because medical experts call the cancer link a myth and say that those who think there is a link there are quacks and cranks and nuts. Finally, you learn that your own doctor recently attended a medical seminar. The lecture that he attended confirmed how effective Cholextra is, so he sends you off with some free samples and a prescription. You've really done your homework. But what if all isn't as it seems? What if the reality you found was false? A carefully constructed narrative by unseen special interests designed to manipulate your opinion. A Truman Show-esque alternate reality all around you. Complacency in the news media combined with incredibly powerful propaganda and publicity forces mean we sometimes get little of the truth. Special interests have unlimited time and money to figure out new ways to spin us while cloaking their role. Surreptitious astroturf methods are now more important to these interests than traditional lobbying of Congress. There's an entire industry built around it in Washington. What is astroturf? It's a perversion of grassroots. as in fake grassroots. AstroTurf is when political, corporate, or other special interests disguise themselves and publish blogs, start Facebook and Twitter accounts, publish ads, letters to the editor, or simply post comments online to try to fool you into thinking an independent or grassroots movement is speaking. The whole point of AstroTurf is to try to give the impression there's widespread support for or against an agenda when there's not. AstroTurf seeks to manipulate you into changing your opinion by making you feel as if you're an outlier when you're not. One example is the Washington Redskins name. Without taking a position on the controversy, if you simply were looking at news media coverage over the course of the past year or looking at social media, you'd probably have to conclude that most Americans find that name offensive and think it ought to be changed. But what if I told you 71% of Americans say the name should not be changed? That's more than two-thirds. AstroTurfers seek to controversialize those who disagree with them. They attack news organizations that publish stories they don't like, whistleblowers who tell the truth, politicians who dare to ask the tough questions, and journalists who have the audacity to report on all of it. Sometimes AstroTurfers simply shove intentionally so much confusing and conflicting information into the mix that you're left to throw up your hands and disregard all of it, including the truth. Drown out a link between a medicine and a harmful side effect, say vaccines and autism, by throwing a bunch of conflicting paid-for studies, surveys, and experts into the mix, confusing the truth beyond recognition. And then there's Wikipedia. AstroTurf's dream come true. Billed as the free encyclopedia that anyone can edit, the reality can't be more different. Anonymous Wikipedia editors control and co-opt pages on behalf of special interests. They forbid and reverse edits that go against their agenda. They skew and delete information in blatant violation of Wikipedia's own established policies with impunity, always superior to the poor schlubs who actually believe anyone can edit Wikipedia, only to discover they're barred from correcting even the simplest factual inaccuracies. Try adding a footnoted fact or correcting a fact error on one of these monitored Wikipedia pages and poof, sometimes within a matter of seconds you'll find your edit is reversed. In 2012, famed author Philip Roth tried to correct a major fact error about the inspiration behind one of his book characters cited on a Wikipedia page. But no matter how hard he tried, Wikipedia's editors wouldn't allow it. They kept reverting the edits back to the false information. When Roth finally reached a person at Wikipedia, which was no easy task, and tried to find out what was going wrong, they told him he simply was not considered a credible source on himself. A few weeks later, there was a huge scandal when Wikipedia officials got caught offering a PR service that skewed and edited information on behalf of paid, publicity-seeking clients in utter opposition to Wikipedia's supposed policies. All of this may be why, when a medical study looked at medical conditions described on Wikipedia pages and compared it to actual peer-reviewed published research, Wikipedia contradicted medical research 90% of the time. You may never fully trust what you read on Wikipedia again, nor should you. Let's now go back to that fictitious Calextra example and all the research you did. It turns out the Facebook and Twitter accounts you found that were so positive were actually written by paid professionals hired by the drug company to promote the drug. The Wikipedia page had been monitored by an agenda editor also paid by the drug company. The drug company also arranged to optimize Google search engine results, so it was no accident that you stumbled across that positive nonprofit that had all those positive comments. The nonprofit was, of course, secretly founded and funded by the drug company. The drug company also financed that positive study and used its power of editorial control to omit any mention of cancer as a possible side effect. Once more, each and every doctor who publicly touted Calextra or called the cancer link a myth or ridiculed critics as paranoid cranks and quacks or served on the government advisory board that approved the drug, each of those doctors is actually a paid consultant for the drug company. As for your own doctor, the medical lecture he attended that had all those positive evaluations was, in fact, like many continuing medical education classes, sponsored by the drug company. And when the news reported on that positive study, it didn't mention any of that. I have tons of personal examples from real life. A couple of years ago, CBS News asked me to look into a story about a study coming out from the nonprofit National Sleep Foundation. Supposedly, this press release coming out said, The study concluded we are a nation with an epidemic of sleeplessness and we don't even know it, and we should all go ask our doctors about it. A couple of things struck me about that. First, I recognize the phrase, ask your doctor, as a catchphrase promoted by the pharmaceutical industry. They know that if they can get your foot through the door of the doctor's office to mention a malady, you're very likely to be prescribed the latest drug that's marketed. Second, I wondered how serious an epidemic of sleeplessness could really be if we don't even know that we have it. Right? It didn't take long for me to do a little research and discover that the National Sleep Foundation nonprofit and the study, which was actually a survey, not a study, were sponsored in part by a new drug that was about to be launched onto the market called Lunesta, a sleeping pill. I reported the study as CBS News asked, but of course I disclosed the sponsorship behind the nonprofit and the survey so that viewers could weigh the information accordingly. All the other news media reported the same survey directly off the press release as written without digging past the superficial. It later became an example written up in the Columbia Journalism Review, which quite accurately reported that only we at CBS News had bothered to do a little bit of research and disclose the conflict of interest behind this widely reported survey. So now you may be thinking, what can I do? I thought I'd done my research. What chance do I have separating fact from fiction, especially if seasoned journalists with years of experience can be so easily fooled? Well, I have a few strategies that I can tell you about to help you recognize signs of propaganda and astroturf. Once you start to know what to look for, you'll begin to recognize it everywhere. First, hallmarks of astroturf include use of inflammatory language such as crank, quack, nutty, lies, paranoid, pseudo, and conspiracy. Astroturfers often claim to debunk myths that aren't myths at all. Use of the charged language tests well. People hear something's a myth, maybe they find it on Snopes, and they instantly declare themselves too smart to fall for it. But what if the whole notion of the myth is itself a myth and you and Snopes fell for that? Beware when interests attack an issue by controversializing or attacking the people, personalities, and organizations surrounding it rather than addressing the facts. That could be astroturf. And most of all, astroturfers tend to reserve all of their public skepticism for those exposing wrongdoing rather than the wrongdoers. In other words, instead of questioning authority, they question those who question authority. You might start to see things a little more clearly. It's kind of like taking off your glasses and wiping them and putting them back on and realizing for the first time how foggy they'd been all along. I can't resolve these issues, but I hope that I've given you some information that will at least motivate you to take off your glasses and wipe them and become a wiser consumer of information in an increasingly artificial, paid-for reality. Thank you.
And now we'll hear from the third speaker, three-time Emmy Award-winning journalist Amber Lyon, who worked for CNN. And this is from a 2013 interview on RT America, where Amber reveals CNN lies and war propaganda. And here she is.
Well, I really worry here that the United States public is being led into another potential conflict with Iran, the similar way that we were led into the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, because you're starting to see the mainstream media really overhype the situation in Iran and omit important facts. And if you look at all the propaganda being fed to the American public right now in terms of Iran, we have movies here coming out, Argo. We've got the mainstream media oversaturation of coverage of the Iran situation. And based on everything that's happening here in the U.S. with the mortgage crisis, the economy, the fact that most Americans are having problems just getting by day to day, the fact that the mainstream media is overcovering Iran only says one thing to me, and that's that the American public is being propagated into another war. And this is something that goes back to the terms weapons of mass destruction. The American public was fed that phrase over and over and over leading into the Iraq war. And now we're starting to see it as far as nuclear weapons and Iran goes in the U.S. And I just fear that the public is continuing to be fed propaganda that unassuming Americans don't realize they're being fed to lead us into another potential conflict. I really can't speculate as to exactly why this is going on, but I can tell you that when I was working for CNN, we did have a documentary that we aired on the Bahrain situation. And that's where we have our naval base, which is right across from Iran. So we strategically want to keep that naval base. And it was very difficult to get stories on about Bahrain. I even came out a couple weeks ago talking about the censorship of that documentary on CNN International. And above all, I feel that the American public is not being fed the true story about what's going on in this region. And it's very dangerous because when the public is constantly fed messages that are potentially leading us into a war that may not be necessary, it's not fair to the American people and it's not fair to journalism because the truth isn't being told here. What's being told here is the way that these networks want to spin the truth, and that's leading us into another potential conflict with Iran. And I've been trying to tell my followers on my Facebook page and on Twitter to really open your eyes, because once you notice, you take the blindfold off, you start to see all of this anti-Iran propaganda floating through the American mainstream media. And it's symbolic of exactly what was going on before the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. I still haven't been given an exact reason as to why it didn't air. I went and visited with the president of CNN International, Tony Maddox, twice on behalf of my dumbfounded crew, and we were never given an answer. And so I started investigating the situation after several employees who'd been at the network for years approached me and said, you need to look into this. There's something going on. It's very strange. They're not airing your documentary. And after some investigation, we found out that CNN International is actually making money from the Bahrain regime. They are a customer of Bahrain. Bahrain is paying CNN International to create content that shows Bahrain in a favorable light. Also, not only to create that content, to then air that content on CNN International. In one of the shows, it was called I List Bahrain. It was back in 2010. It was sponsored by Bahrain. And Richard Quest was live from the country for a week talking about the Formula One race and how progressive Bahrain was and how the Crown Prince was a reformer. Well, we saw in February 2011 that under the Crown Prince's rule, the military troops shot and killed unarmed protesters in broad daylight. And this is very dangerous because what CNN is doing, and they're not only taking money from just Bahrain, they've also produced similar content for Georgia, Kazakhstan, and other nations as well, Lebanon. And what makes this dangerous is they're not disclosing to the viewers that these sponsored programs are actually being sponsored. Or if they are disclosing it, it's in very small gray lettering at the bottom of the article. And that's dangerous not only to our foreign policy, but once again, making the American public and the public in general that's watching this network think that there are rosy situations happening in these countries when that's not the case, as we've seen with Bahrain. And it's defrauding viewers and it's defrauding their own journalists. I was not told as a journalist working at the network that this was going on. It wasn't clearly disclosed to me that at the same time I was investigating the Bahrain regime, Bahrain was a paying customer at CNN. They never told us why they weren't playing it, even though I asked the head of CNN International twice about it. And even bosses above me told me they didn't have answers for me, and I'd have to go searching for those answers. So that pretty much, as an investigative reporter, tells me that something's going on. So on behalf of my crew, I got to get to the bottom of things. We had fixers and drivers in Bahrain who are currently now have been laid off because they helped us film that documentary. Some who are continually still harassed. Doctors Without Borders employee who actually drove us into these villages to show us doctors who'd been beaten by security forces. He risked his safety. Several months after our documentary, his home was burnt down. And in part, activists say because he helped CNN with that documentary. These sources, these people on the ground did not know that at the same time CNN was taking money from this regime to make rosy content that would negate their content. And they risked their lives. And I feel like CNN owes them an apology as well as an apology to viewers and its own journalists for defrauding them with this information.
So there you have it. Three journalists telling us how the controlled, complicit, corrupt, and compromised corporate and sometimes quote, alternative media really work. Based on these revelations, is it any wonder that we don't hear about the mountains of censored evidence that proves the official account of 9/11 to be totally fraudulent? Perhaps we could learn from Bahrain and buy our way onto these corrupt media outlets. But one thing we can surely do to exercise our people power is to just turn them off. And this concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and myself, Mimi Rosenberg. This is the 20th year of welfare reform, or what some of us refer to as welfare deconstruction and destruction. April McCrae thought she had finally caught a break in late 2005. That's when the state of Louisiana granted cash assistance to the single mother through the Temporary Assistance of Needy Families, or TANF, program. It was her first experience with America's welfare program. McCrae, who had been in and out of work, struggled to make ends meet. This, she hoped, would at least help soften the burden. But a month later, the state stripped her of the benefits without a clear explanation, she said. Since then, she says, Louisiana, which controls state and federally allocated TANF dollars, has denied her request for assistance several times. It gets depressing, said McCrae, who in 2016 is still struggling with three kids and rarely more than a part-time job. April says she needs help she can't seem to get from a welfare system that was overhauled 20 years ago. As far as whether people are better off, I don't think so. In most cases, I think they're worse off.
20 years ago on April 22nd, then-President Bill Clinton signed the Welfare Reform and Construction Law that imposed work requirements and term limits on public assistance into effect, and people like April McCrae across the country have been left destitute.
There are advocates who, in the wake of the shredding of the social safety net, such as those in New York, who are demanding an end to the Work Experience Program, WEP, increased allowances to reflect the cost of living, and more humane treatment at public assistance centers for the millions of poor women like April McCrae and their children across the nation.
But like April McCrae, we're left to wonder why across the spectrum those seeking electoral office and why their platforms fail to meaningfully address poverty and seek to reverse 20 years of the harmful legacies of the 1990s Welfare Reform and Destruction Act.
So let's put this question to Felicia Kornbluh, author of the forthcoming Ensuing Poverty, The History and Politics of Welfare Reform. Felicia Kornbluh is Associate Professor of History and Gender, Sexuality, and Women's Studies at the University of Vermont, and she's also authored The Battle for Welfare.
Delighted to be here.
So let's begin with that very question, which is, why is there such reticence and difficulty? And first, let's start with the Clinton administration. Since Hillary Clinton professes to be a feminist, this is an issue primarily, first and foremost, about women. And she was formative in the 20 years ago deconstruction of welfare as we know it. And it was under Bill Clinton's presidency. So why are we hearing nothing about what is to be done?
I think Hillary Clinton has good reasons to not want to talk about the issue. She would rather not reopen this particular can of worms. And it's very interesting because so many of the other policies of the early and mid-90s, so many policies of the Clinton administration have now come under question and reexamination. And suddenly things that it seems like we couldn't talk about before 2016, suddenly we are talking about, I think, thanks to Bernie Sanders, thanks to a lot of popular forces, thanks to Black Lives Matter, we are talking about the crime bill of 1994, and we are talking about NAFTA and about the endorsement of trade deals that weren't good for many American workers and that were opposed by the labor movement. But we haven't really talked very much, at least in the mainstream, about welfare reform, and I think Hillary would rather kind of let that sit. I don't know if I could say that she was formative herself. I think it's certainly fair to say she did not object. And there were others, including many longtime friends and allies of hers, including Marion Wright Edelman of the Children's Defense Fund, which Hillary had been on the board of for many years. There were others, including Wright Edelman, who did object very vociferously. And Hillary certainly did not join them in objecting. So I think now she would just like it if we would all kind of forget about welfare reform and just not talk about it.
Felicia, let's get more into detail about what the effects of this so-called reform was in 1996 that they called welfare reform.
Well, the main aspects of the changed law, of the new law, were that time limits were introduced to welfare receipt for the first time in our history. We started as a country providing these benefits at the national level in 1935 with the Social Security Act. And then we started providing them at the state and municipal level early in the 20th century. And really, really, it's a continuation of programs that go back to, you know, the 17th century or to even parish-based relief in England, you know, in the medieval and early modern period. So this is it's a very old principle that when you're destitute and in times of need, your community will provide for you. And it's very, very old that the people who are going to need that provision are overwhelmingly disabled people and women with young children. So for the first time, our country said in 1996, there's a time limit. So you can only get these benefits for 5 years for the entirety of your life. No matter how many kids you are, no matter what your circumstances are, et cetera. And there was a little bit of provision at the margins for people who might have trouble, women who were victims of domestic violence, for example. In certain states, not even in every state, but in certain states, there's an option, a family violence option, to recuse women from that time limit. And then the other piece of it was a work requirement. After 2 years on the roll, the maximum of 2 years, and in some states it's much less, but after a maximum of 2 years, if you're receiving financial benefits from the government under this TANF program, then you also need to be engaged in some market work. So raising your kids isn't enough. Going to school or training is not enough. You also need to be doing some market work. So those were the key things. And it was kind of an extension of what had been going on before, but it was also a very dramatic shift that occurred in 1996. And what was most remarkable about it probably was that it was signed by a Democratic president who some people think is a liberal.
Felicia, before we get into the fact that it is time to end this version of welfare as we know it, I want to just get people disavowed of the notion that there is not a systemic reason that women and their children are the ones that are the poorest sector of our society. So help take us through a kind of history that lets us understand why women have been left in such an impoverished state and why we think it is the responsibility of the state to deal with the kind of abject poverty that they are confronted with in the form of a social service network and safety net system.
In some ways, this is a difficult issue for feminists, and I consider myself a strong feminist. But it's a kind of feminism that of course, understands in a liberal framework, understands women's autonomy, that we have to respect women's autonomy and that women, you know, should be free to make their own choices just as all other citizens are. But we also recognize that women historically have had and continue to have primary responsibility for raising children. So the kind of feminism that I'm interested in, a class-sensitive feminism, what I think of as a reality-sensitive feminism, which is also a racially-sensitive feminism, is a feminism that recognizes that overwhelmingly women in our society are given and themselves kind of take up the primary responsibility for raising children. And because that's true and because it's been true for many, many years, that imposes certain financial obligations in addition to obligations to do the work of caring for children. So it is work. It is work that many people love and to which many people give their lives or significant parts of their lives. And as a society, we don't do a very good job of respecting that work. So what the old welfare system used to do really inadequately and really partially, but at least did it, was recognize that there were going to be women raising kids without the benefit of male partners, husbands or lovers, for a variety of reasons, and that they were going to be doing that socially valuable work, and that they needed some kind of a floor under them economically. And since 1996, I feel like we've been living in a kind of weird fantasy world, and my terrible suspicion is that a kind of bourgeois feminism, an upper class, generally white women's feminism, has helped to obscure the fact that women still are disproportionately raising kids and that does produce certain kinds of economic consequences and need for women and children who are in these very, very impoverished families.
Lisa, you've been talking about this for many, many years, but unfortunately, many, many other people have not been talking about it, even now during the current electoral cycle. Why do you think that is?
Well, my co-author, Gwendolyn Mink, and I have described it as kind of the hole in the middle of the donut in our politics. And I don't mean to be cutesy about that, but I think it's just been really interesting. If we just look at people on the Democratic side of things, I mean, the Republicans they're doing their own politics. But just on the Democratic side, I was in some ways very inspired by Bernie Sanders's campaign. I'm from Vermont. I voted for Sanders in the primary. Sanders really is most comfortable with a kind of old-fashioned, social democratic, class-based politics. And his general approach is that if we pursue policies like universal health care, right, single payer, we sometimes call it government health care, that will help everyone. It'll help women and it'll help people of color and it'll help everybody, right? So that's what we need to do, is we need to pursue those policies, which are class sensitive, but not gender sensitive or racially sensitive or anything like that. We need to reach the most people, right? And then Hillary Clinton has been pursuing a politics which is kind of gender sensitive and racially sensitive, and at least at the level of saying, like, I'm a woman and it makes a difference when a woman is making policy. And to some degree, she has talked about care work in certain limited ways and, you know, in terms of reform she's proposed of the Social Security system and stuff like that. But she's really not talking about issues of class and about the things that are facing working people or even more people who are not working, who are really, really in trouble these days, right? So we wind up with, you know, two interesting and in some ways productive kinds of politics, but neither one is reaching the situation of low-income women of color. Or even low-income white women, who many of whom find themselves in really desperate situations today. And somebody's got to fill that gap. Neither politics is really going to do the trick.
So what you're saying is that, and I know you've called it this economic universalism that proceeds as though gender doesn't matter, proceeds as though race doesn't matter. It kind of subjugates or subordinates those special considerations which have a history and a presence of their own. So if you're doing a kind of generic one size fits all, in fact, it fits none.
So, yeah, in the United States, I think we just can't do that politics. We can't start in 2016 and say, wipe the slate clean. We just won't talk about race. We just won't talk about gender. I think it doesn't work. And if we try and create a universalistic politics and we don't talk about people's particular needs and histories, then I think we're going to wind up doing harm. We're going to wind up leaving people out.
So then the Democratic platform should certainly restore income support for low-income caregivers. And I wonder if you can expound on that. Definitely there are things like reform things. The work requirements should be eliminated. The time limits should be eliminated. The sanctions, which in New York there is currently a moratorium on, but they're going to be restored in September, albeit with some tooling around the edges so they won't be as oppressive. But what is to be done that would make a system that is more conducive to the needs of and more responsive to women and children who are the primary people who are poor within our society?
Maybe this is the good news. We don't have to look very far to think about how we could create a much more humane and workable system. What if, for example, we took the old age insurance program that we usually call Social Security as our model? Old age insurance, you know, was created at the same time as the old welfare program. It was created in 1935. It was just a different part of the same law, right? Old age insurance was for older Americans who had had certain kinds of work histories, and the old welfare program was for low-income women and children. But they always were set up differently, they were administratively different, and it was always much harder for women and children to get access to their benefits than it was for older retired Americans to get access to their benefits. But what if we just followed that Social Security model? So then it would be a nationally administered program. It wouldn't be subject to local and state level control and all the abuses that are introduced there. It also wouldn't be so expensive to administer if it was run by the federal government. We could just do some kind of simple income eligibility check and then, you know, send people their checks in the mail without the kind of massive bureaucracy that we have now to check people's eligibility constantly. And we make women and children wait around in the welfare office for hours and hours and hours. You know, we could get rid of time limits with a stroke of a pen, or with the stroke of congressional action. We could get rid of time limits. And instead of imposing these onerous work requirements, we could make work voluntary. You know, what we found out in the 1980s in states like Massachusetts, when they had a voluntary work program for women who were receiving welfare benefits, the program was completely full. It's not that women don't want to work. You know, they're just facing a mismatch in a labor market that, first of all, doesn't have enough jobs, and it certainly doesn't have enough good jobs. You know, so why not just make it voluntary? And then the other thing is give people genuine opportunities. People want opportunities. People want to go to school. Right now, if you're receiving welfare benefits and you want to go back and get some kind of a degree, even a vocationally oriented degree, it's almost impossible. You know, I read these stories of women taking 3 buses with their kids and, you know, creating some kind of a daycare system, and then they find out that the education program isn't covered. It's not considered an appropriate education program under their under the terms of their welfare receipt, or they're only allowed to be in a program for such a short amount of time that they can't get any decent kind of vocational training, to say nothing of, you know, really meaningful basic education. It's just crazy. It's the whole thing is just a farce of opportunity. We have the word opportunity in the law. We're not providing people any opportunities, and we could. We really could do it.
Some people may say this sounds really radical, but there are precedents for this in our history. Even the Republicans at some point were on board for something like this. So is this such a departure from the past?
I don't think it is. I think we could see it as a renewal of some of our basic values. As I was saying a little bit ago, the roots of this policy really are very, very old in England and in the United States. And probably also in the other countries that that sent people to these shores in the 17th and 18th centuries. I just don't know those histories as well. But certainly in England and the U.S., you know, it's a very normal thing that we provide for women and children in times of need. What's extraordinary is that we now operate in a kind of fantasy world that people don't need this kind of assistance. And of course, you know, we've never done it great. We've never been as generous as we could be or as we should be, and we can do better than that. One thing I think about a lot is both in the 1970s and today, a lot of people call for a basic income that wouldn't just be for moms and kids. It would be for everybody. And I'm also very moved by that idea. And, you know, sounds radical in some ways, but it's actually pretty easy to do. And it makes a lot of sense. There are a lot of people in Silicon Valley and elsewhere calling for this because they know that in our highly technological society, there's just going to be a lot of unemployment, you know, and there's no reason for us to demand that everyone be in the labor market. It's just nutty that we think that the only way that you can kind of earn the right to live on this earth is by performing waged labor, no matter what kind of waged labor that would be. So then we wind up like resisting new technology and resisting more efficient factories or whatever. Like, why, you know, why as a society should we be putting ourselves in that position? So, you know, if we have to do it in a way that's universal and we give everybody basic income, let's just make sure that we're also providing adequately for mothers and children, and that we're also providing adequately for communities of color that have been kind of left out of the resource race up to this point.
Well, one of the things that you point out in your writing is the outsized rate of single mother poverty, nearly 40% in 2014, which should command our attention. It hasn't really. And I'm interested in your thoughts about paid family leave, a higher minimum wage, equal pay, accessible child care. Are these the issues that we should be directing our attention to, or in some ways do those also attenuate the specific inequalities that make and keep so many single mothers poor?
Yes, I believe that we should pursue all of those things, and we should, you know, we should do them all at once. I would caution anyone who thinks that we could make the problem of single mother poverty go away with a good child care system, for example. I would just caution people about that. I think there is a role, and there will continue to be a role, for cash assistance. And that's in some ways the hardest nut for us as a culture. Giving people cash in times of need. It's really fine. It's morally fine to do that. It makes a lot of sense. People need it. And as we've seen since 1996, the big finding since 1996 is when we take the cash away, we really do create misery. We really do reduce people's lifespans. We really do reduce their health, you know, not just their access to health care. We reduce their actual lived experience. We reduce their health. And we've been doing that as a culture, and we need to stop doing it. Giving people food stamps is not good enough. Giving people services is not good enough. People need cash.
One of the things that you point out, again, in your writing is that, and really it deserves to be said again, that women are, for so many reasons, overrepresented in the least well-paid professions with the most limited access to decent family-supporting benefits. The issue of women's poverty is a systemic one ingrained in the cultural reality of this country, and it needs to be said more aggressively to counter the mythologies of those women who are on public assistance, are recipients, who, of course, we had terms in the past like welfare queens, etc., to connote a kind of complacency and laziness, as though the state was doling out something that was otherwise undeserved and was opportunistically sought. So take us out of that terrible kind of mythology that I dare say too many people certainly still have, and most decidedly within the Republican Party camp.
I think you're pointing up something which is important, which is that many, many women, including many mothers, are in the labor market right now, and many want to be. And so we need to expand our brains, I think, enough to understand that sexism and racism and I guess what we could call class subordination, that exists in the labor market and exists outside the labor market for people who aren't in the labor market or who aren't in the labor market very much, right? And to some degree, we need different strategies. I mean, I think we need some kind of a class and race-sensitive basic income regardless. But we may also need really specific policies that will raise wages to an adequate level and do that nationally. And we need policies that support people who are in the labor market. Of course, we need a decent, I would say, universal system of child care comparable to the ones that they have in many Western European countries. You know, it seems like they're all able to afford it. We can afford it. We do need a system of paid family leave so that when people have children biologically or when they adopt children, they don't suffer such terrible poverty that it winds up, you know, being a kind of disciplinary thing and keeping people at work when they really feel like they need to be home with their young children. You know, I think we need to work on both fronts. We need to work on the labor market front, and we need to remember that there are people who are not in the labor market, and remember, as a society, we do not need to force them into the labor market.
Well, Felicia, we thank you. And I really do encourage people to read the Battle for Welfare Rights, which Felicia is an author of, along with Gwendolyn Mink. And there is, of course, the forthcoming book, which we will get you back for soon, which is Ensuring Poverty, the History and Politics of Welfare Reform, 20 years of deconstruction, really, and tearing apart, shredding the safety net. Thanks for giving us a sense of how we can reform that. What are the issues behind welfare deconstruction? And most critically, what a society that is truly about women's values and women would look like financially to support those who are the most impoverished sector of our society. So again, Felicia Kornblut, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for your work.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap. You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
We were the three that took on changing the definition of spouse in British Columbia in every piece of legislation.
It was around that time somebody told me there was a queer Muslim conference happening in New York.
There's a gay pride, the first ever, happening in Venice Beach, California. That's so, so amazing.
I am a horny and I'm here because I want to shake my...
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Uganda's ethics minister promises persistent persecution of homos, pride lands on the beaches of Venice, California, and redefining spouse sets the stage for Canadian equality. Those stories and more this week, now that you've chosen This Way Out.
I'm Carol Myers.
And I'm John Dyer V.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending August 20th, 2016. The government of Uganda, led by its obsessively homophobic ethics minister, Simon Lokoto, is promising that it will continue to suppress the country's sexual and gender minorities. Lokoto quit the Roman Catholic priesthood in 2011 to become the government's Minister of Ethics and Integrity. He bragged during an interview this week with the notoriously anti-queer tabloid Red Pepper about the August 4th police raid on Kampala's Mr. and Miss Pride pageant, calling the participants shameless idiots who were planning to sin. He rejected what he said were Western demands that Uganda trade financial aid for the acceptance of homosexuality. They can keep their monies, he said. Africans lived before the white man came here. God will provide. Visiting evangelicals from the U.S., peddling a religious cure for homosexuality in the past decade, fueled the already hostile environment for LGBT people in the East African country to a fever pitch. Lokoto, described by the Red Pepper as an amiable man of God, said that, despite his country's crushing poverty, the government would be purchasing machines manufactured in South Korea that will detect homos in social media messaging. He went on to claim that, "The homos have been sending me messages threatening my life. Most of them even say they want to rape me," he said. "But I don't fear anything."
In happier news for LGBT people, a first-ever Pride March in the Ukrainian city of Odessa was held on August 13th. About 100 people came together along Primorsky Boulevard following a streetwide rainbow banner, protected by some 700 officers of the National Police. There were no major disruptions by far-right nationalists who had threatened violence. Authorities in Ukraine's third-largest city had first banned the march altogether, but relented as long as it stayed away from Shevchenko Park, named for one of Ukraine's most beloved writers. Gia Lortkipanidze, police chief of the Odessa region, was on hand in person to ensure that the event stayed nonviolent. About 20 anti-queer protesters were arrested for trying to breach the parade lines, but no injuries were reported. The Pride organizers hailed the successful march on their official Facebook page, writing that, "Now the whole world sees that Odessa is really an open and safe city in which there is a place for all." On June 12th, about 6,000 police officers guarded an estimated 1,000 participants in a march for equality in Kiev. There were no significant disruptions there either, in contrast to verbal and physical attacks on pride marchers in the Ukrainian capital in previous years. Jeffrey Pyatt, the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, called the peaceful Odessa Pride proof that Ukraine is changing.
But in a legal setback for LGBT people in the United States this week, a district court ruling supported the firing of a transgender worker by a funeral home in a Detroit, Michigan area suburb. Amy Stevens had worked at the R.G. and G.R. Harris Funeral Home as a funeral director and embalmer since 2007. She informed her employer in 2013 that she would be transitioning and planned to wear clothing at work appropriate to her new gender identity. She was fired 2 weeks later for what she was proposing to do. Stevens was supported in her claim by the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. The funeral home director testified that he would be violating God's commands if he allowed Stevens to present as female at work. District Court Judge Sean Cox decided that the business was entitled to discriminate under provisions of the Religious Freedom Exemption Act because not doing so would impose a substantial burden on its ability to conduct business in accordance with its sincerely held religious beliefs. Cox's August 18th ruling ran against the tide of recent federal court decisions that U.S. civil rights laws banning bias based on sex also protect transgender people from discrimination.
But the decision seems to be consistent with a 2014 U.S. Supreme Court ruling involving Hobby Lobby's denial of contraception to its employees under the company's health care plan. The High Court allowed it and other closely held for-profit companies to be considered as individuals under the Religious Freedom Exemption Act, and therefore be permitted to cite religious beliefs for denying the contraception benefit to its workers. Jillian Weiss of the Transgender Legal Defense and Education Fund joined a chorus of LGBT rights groups condemning this week's district court ruling. "We cannot go back to the days," she said, "in which people could be forced to conform to employers' gender stereotypes in order to keep their jobs." The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission tweeted that it was disappointed with the decision and is reviewing next steps.
In other news, Tony Perkins, who leads the infamously anti-queer Family Research Council, found out this week that karma can be a bitch. He's among a number of far-right Christian conservative leaders who've claimed that God uses hurricanes, earthquakes, tornadoes, and lethal diseases to punish people for sinning, especially gay people. He specifically called recent hurricanes a sign of God's wrath for the legalization of gay marriage. Perkins was among the thousands of people made homeless this week by record rainfall of what he called near-biblical proportions in and around Baton Rouge, Louisiana. He phoned into his own Family Research Council radio show to say that he and his family were forced to escape their flooded home in a canoe. But never one to miss trying to make a silk purse out of a sow's ear, Perkins said that the natural disaster offered a chance for Christians to rejoice that God considers them worthy of suffering for his sake. The flooding has caused the deaths of at least 13 people and left more than 40,000 people homeless.
But help in many forms is on the way. The National Basketball Association announced last month that it was pulling its 2017 All-Star Game out of Charlotte because of North Carolina's onerous law known as HB 2. It denies local governments the right to enact LGBT anti-bias protections and requires trans people to use the bathrooms that match the gender on their birth certificates. The NBA confirmed on August 19th that the new location of the 2017 All-Star Game would be New Orleans. Despite the devastating flooding nearby, the Crescent City has remained relatively dry. The All-Star Game will be an economic boon to the state. Louisiana Governor John Bel Edwards, a Democrat, issued an executive order when he took office in January banning anti-LGBT bias in state employment and services, and rescinding an order by his predecessor, Republican Bobby Jindal, which allowed such discrimination. Even though Louisiana doesn't have statewide anti-bias protections for LGBT people, neither have lawmakers considered a law similar to North Carolina's HB 2. Edwards pitched the NBA on holding the 2017 All-Star Game in New Orleans last month because of what he called his state's commitment to diversity and equality. "Even in the midst of a historic crisis," he said in a celebratory statement, "I am excited that the NBA has recognized how great the city of New Orleans and the state of Louisiana are."
And finally, Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump made an unusual teleprompted speech about terrorism this week, as opposed to his usual freewheeling off-the-cuff comments. He called for the extreme vetting of immigrants, suggesting that they pass an ideological test before being allowed into the country. His advisors have told reporters that such a test might include support for religious pluralism, women's rights, and even LGBT rights. But out lesbian CNN News commentator Sally Cohn said after the speech that Trump's promises don't pass the smell test.
We cannot let the hateful ideology of radical Islam, its oppression of women, gays, children, and non-believers, be allowed to reside or spread within our own countries.
If we're going to start doing an ideological test and not allow into this country people who don't support gender equality and LGBT rights, then, I don't know, how about the entire Republican Party platform committee that voted to say that it should be okay to send your kids to anti-gay, destructive, homophobic conversion therapy? Why don't we get rid of them? Just one example. I'm sorry, this whole want to use gay rights and women's rights not to actually give gay rights and women's rights to people in this country, but simply as a fig leaf to bash Muslims. Let me be clear, there are Muslims in this world, including in this country, who are far better on gay rights and women's rights than many of the people in the Republican Party.
That's News Wrap for the week ending August 20th, 2016, produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Carol Myers.
And I'm John Dyer V.
Pride premieres in Venice, California, and a bad breakup becomes good news in Queer Canada later in the program. Lesbian athletes have hit it big at the 2016 Rio Olympic Games. Brazil's Rafaela Silver took gold in her judo category, and Italian swimmer Rachel Brunei won silver and came out by dedicating the win to her beloved. The much-touted first same-gender married participants Kate and Helen Richardson-Walsh's British hockey team beat the Netherlands for the gold, with Kate scoring one of the winning penalties in the final shootout. On the downside for Team LGBT, it was a heartbreaking loss for Britain's Tom Daley. Daley medaled in last week's synchronized diving competition, but shockingly sank to last place this week in the 10-meter platform diving competition. Off the playing field, NBC made up for its original mishandling of the relationship between British beach volleyballer Larissa Franca and her wife Lilaine Mastriani by airing a beautiful profile of the couple. In the ally category, U.S. gymnast Dan Oliva won two silver medals in Rio. Just after making the team, and soon after the Pulse massacre in Orlando, Leyva recorded a video in support of the LGBT community.
Recently, there has been much said about trans rights and the danger people fear they may pose if they are allowed to use whatever bathroom they wish. These people, of course, are wrong. The danger comes from bigotry, not the victims of it. And it is our responsibility as non-LGBT people to help create a world where LGBT people don't need to create their own safe spaces. That is a promise I'm making, and I hope you will join me in making it.
Hello, I'm Billy Beane, Major League Baseball's Ambassador for Inclusion, and you are listening to This Way Out, the international radio show for all our sexually diverse communities.
By the end of the 90s, the Supreme Court of Canada was no longer giving governments the flexibility to recognize gay rights on their own timeline.
Still to come, more from Canada's queer decade. But first, he keep moving west from Los Angeles Pride's parade route through West Hollywood, and you'll find yourself in Venice Beach, where the sunset of one tradition led to the dawn of a new one. This Way Out correspondent Matthew McLaughlin takes us to the eccentric enclave.
In response to the closing of the West Side's only gay bar, the Roosterfish, as well as in memoriam to L.A. City Councilman and LGBT family member Bill Rosenthal, the City of Venice held its inaugural Gay Pride celebration. Hosted by Councilman Mike Bonin, sponsors included Silicon Beach Editions, Snapchat, and Google, as well as the Irwin Hotel and local beachfront restaurant and bar, Danny's, owned by Venice resident Danny Samakow, who opened his doors to the town's LGBT community with Surfs Up Fridays.
I'm Daniel Savico, and I'm part of the Venice community.
And as owner of Danny's Venice, yes. With the Roosterfish closing, you've kind of stepped up.
Yes, actually, you know, with the Roosterfish closing, I was just going to speak about that because Bill Rosenthal said, Daniel, we need to keep a place for the community to meet. And essentially, I'll announce tonight that Danny's is going to be that place for the community. We're starting with Wednesdays and Fridays nights, doing events those nights, and then we'll go on into other nights as well.
That's fantastic. What a wonderful tribute to Bill.
Bill, our first gay, openly gay city council person. I only wish he was here tonight. He would be in his element. Oh, my God. Yeah. That's a thing that was a long time coming. Venice is such a community of diversity and acceptance that we should be celebrating Pride. We do celebrate Pride literally every day in Venice, but it's nice to do it this way.
Thank you so much. Have a great time tonight.
This was haphazard. I just kind of found out about it just by perusing around and doing some disco research, okay? And then I find out there's a gay pride, the first ever happening in Venice Beach. Venice Beach!
Took a while.
Venice, California! That's so, so amazing to hear. I think people refuse to let go of the word grassroots, you know? I mean, you see what West Hollywood has done and taken West Hollywood to the places where it never used to be.
Yeah.
It used to belong to the people. Look what we've got. They're right now, as you look around, they're all making it their own. They don't know quite what to do yet, you know? So they're texting everybody.
However, if you look out there, organization on the dance floor is formed.
Exactly.
It's the electric boogie.
They're making it their own, and I think that is probably one of the most amazing things that could happen right now.
It's kind of a magical moment.
Good for us.
Nice to share it with you.
A pleasure. A pleasure. Thank
you so much. Who are you and why are you here?
I am a horny and I'm here because I want to shake my...
Are you excited about the first Pride in Venice?
Yes. I'm like a half stripper. I used to be a porn star, so yes.
I'm Kelvin, and I've been a local in Venice for 10 years, and this is a big deal. I don't think people in Venice know how big a deal this is to light the Venice lights, the famous Venice lights, in the colors of the gay rainbow, but it's a big deal, so I'm here to support it.
I'm LJ Carrison. I'm here to celebrate Pride Venice Beach, the first one ever, 2016.
We lost the Roosterfish recently. Do you have any favorite memories of the Roosterfish?
You know, I have lots of fond memories. I actually came out at the Roosterfish, so my memories all began there as a gay man, and I met my first boyfriend ever at the Roosterfish. So lots of fond memories.
Hi, my name is Khadija Murray, and I'm here to enjoy the beach on this awesome day and attend Pride.
It's our first Venice Pride. Would you have any high hopes for it?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I'm really excited to see the sign go up.
Who are you and why are you here tonight?
This is Eric Brown. I'm with the Rock Club Foundation. This one goes out to all the dreamers on behalf of all of us that are still dreaming. I tell you, all the people out there that are still sleeping and never dreaming, wake up. It's time to dream. It's time to live your dreams. It's time to open up your eyes and look up at the sky. And bleeding with the day is blue again, and we live in the war.
The event culminated with the lighting of the Venice sign in the colors of the Pride rainbow, done by trans celebrity Gigi Gorgeous, who pulled the switch.
Hey, what's up? Here, even in the rain, even though I did my hair. I'm so honored to be here, and I'm thrilled to be a part of this amazing ceremony. I mean, Venice Pride is the first one of all, and I mean, it's raining and we're all together, but we've been through much worse, and that's what's most important. We're standing together, and it's all about the love and support today. And I'm here with amazing Mike Bonin. I love him so much. Does anyone want me to speak or no? Should we just get to lighting the Venice sign? Yeah? Okay, let's do it.
All right, everybody, for the first ever lighting of the Venice Pride sign, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Matthew McLaughlin was on the scene at the Venice Beach, California Pride celebration for This Way Out.
Hi, this is Greg Louganis, and you're listening to This Way Out.
It took years of work for Canadian activists to bring about the breakthroughs for LGBT liberation they achieved from 1995 to 2005. That's the period covered in a documentary called Queer Decade, produced for CITR Vancouver, British Columbia, by veteran This Way Out correspondent Heather Kitching. The first part of Queer Decade looked at the Egan versus Canada case that laid the foundation for LGBT rights in Canada. Part two recalls the expansion of the movement to include people of faith and of color, and the victories that opened the path to marriage equality. Kitching's home base in Vancouver gave her a front row seat for those stories.
I moved here in 1990 when I was 17. In 1993, I started a radio show called Queer FM on CITR. I had no idea at the time, but I was about to document one of the most phenomenal decades in the struggle for queer equality, 1995 to 2005. It was the decade we went from no constitutional human rights to full legal marriage.
Hi, I'm Tim Stevenson. Currently a Vancouver City Councillor, and prior to that was an MLA and a Cabinet Minister in the provincial government. In 1996, when I became an MLA, we were struggling just even to change the definition of spouse, and this wasn't even to have marriage. I mean, marriage wasn't even on the radar. Ujo Desage, myself, and now, ironically, Rachel Notley, who's now the Premier of Alberta, we were the three that took on changing the definition of spouse in British Columbia in every piece of legislation in the province. And we were successful. Rachel Notley was a young lawyer, brilliant, and she was a ministerial assistant to Ujo Desage. The Liberal opposition at the time, they were saying, oh, this is just a smokescreen. All you want to do is open this up to marriage. And we kept saying, no, we want to make sure that the definition of spouse has just changed within all of the legislature. That's a different fight. That may come down the line. But and so they were trying to stop it at that point because they saw that as opening the door. And I guess in many ways they're right. I don't think people realize even today as to the monumental decision that was, because anywhere in any piece of legislation that it referred to spouse, that legislation was changed to include gay and lesbian.
By the end of the 90s, the Supreme Court of Canada was no longer giving governments the flexibility to recognize gay rights on their own timeline. In 1998, it ordered the Alberta government to protect lesbian, gay, and bisexual people from discrimination in employment and services. Then, in 1999, it ruled that Ontario had to treat same-sex couples as spouses. The case was called M versus H. It involved a woman who was left penniless after her lesbian partner broke up with her. She tried to sue her ex for spousal support, but Ontario's Family Law Act defined a spouse as an opposite-sex partner. The M versus H decision meant that governments across Canada had to do what BC was already doing, change every law that defined a spouse as an opposite-sex partner to include same-sex partners.
So my name is MTS Poppet. I'm a coordinator of Salaam Vancouver Queer Muslim Community. It was around that time somebody told me there was a queer Muslim conference happening in New York called Al-Fatiha, which was a genesis of the global queer Muslim movement. And to me, that was really important. So I came to Vancouver and we started a chapter of Al-Fatiha in Vancouver. But you know, because Fatiha is not just the opening part of the Quran, it's also a prayer you say when people die at the cemetery. Some people thought that the name Al-Fatiha was kind of morbid. So we changed our name to Salamat, which is the root of Salam. The people and the faith communities were very welcoming. So, you know, we started doing dialogue with queer Jews and then connecting with also with indigenous communities and their spirituality. So I think that was really important because, you know, when people started coming out in the 90s, people couldn't put spirituality and faith and being queer together. It was a struggle for them. And by creating these faith communities, we were giving people an opportunity to say that, yes, we can be queer and Muslim or queer and Christian or queer and Jew. And people were reclaiming that because a lot of people had to leave their faith communities in order to come out as trans, as lesbian, gay, and so on.
My name is Mary Wu Sims, and I'm the former Chief Human Rights Commissioner for British Columbia. I think that as a community, we really grew from thinking of ourselves as predominantly white middle class movement to a seriously rainbow coalition or community. That's not to say that we don't have pockets of racism still that exist in our community or that we don't understand necessarily the plight of people who are poor in our community. You know, there's still a work to be done, but I do think that in those years where we were struggling as a community, we needed help, and there was help that came from all segments of society.
On the next part of Heather Kitching's award-winning documentary...
The issue of who decides what you can or can't read was really the crux of the case.
As a group of people who have undergone seizures after seizures and decades of struggle against Canada Customs, we feel enormously vindicated.
The Little Sisters Bookstore Battle, when Queer Decade returns to This Way Out.
Queer Decade 1995 to 2005 was written and produced by me, Heather Kitching. Madeline Taylor engineered the interviews. Queer Decade uses music composed by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com and licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 3.0. Details are at http://creativecommons.org/licenses/by/3.0. The compositions are called Shades of Spring, Walking Along, Spellbound, Acid Jazz, Chipperdoodle Volume 2, EDM Detection Mode, Ether Disco, Pyro Flow, Danger Storm, Lightness Dawn, Babylon, Son of a Rocket, String Disco, Your Call, and Basement Floor. Queer Decade is a production of CITR Radio and the UBC Centennial Initiatives Fund.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, Carol Myers, John Dyer V, Matthew McLaughlin, and Heather Kitching contributed program material, with thanks as always to Steve Pride. John Williams and Triumph performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener supporters, for making this show possible. Check out the latest program information, pics of the crew, and a lot more at thiswayout.org. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For producer Greg Gordon and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on WOJB Hayward, Wisconsin, KUNR Reno, Nevada, 2CHR Chesnut, New South Wales, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now y'all stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Psychiatric disorders in children seem to be skyrocketing. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention estimate that 1 in 54 boys and 1 in 252 girls have autism spectrum disorder. Over the past 10 years, the number of cases of bipolar disorder have increased 40-fold, and it's estimated that 1 in 10 children have ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. But what is missing from these numbers, and the attention paid to them in the popular media, is something remarkable. Large numbers of children no longer have what are supposed to be lifelong disorders by adulthood. 3/4 of kids with ADHD no longer have the condition by their mid-20s. The same is true of 1/3 of teenagers diagnosed with bipolar disorder. And 1 in 5 toddlers diagnosed with autism no longer meet the diagnosis several years later. So what's going on? Are these disorders somehow waning? Or are children being misdiagnosed with these disorders at an alarming rate? Enrico Nalotti takes the latter position in his book, Back to Normal: Why Ordinary Childhood Behavior is Mistaken for ADHD, Bipolar Disorder, and Autism Spectrum Disorder. That's published by Beacon. Now, Lottie is a clinical psychologist specializing in childhood and adolescent therapy and assessment, and he joins me today. Enrico, let's start with autism. I know you're not suggesting that autism spectrum disorder isn't a real disorder. Why don't you think actual autism is on the increase?
The statistics show that there's been an almost 80% increase over the past decade. And now the rates are like 1 in 88 children supposedly are on the spectrum, like 1 in 54 boys. So boys are diagnosed about 5 times the rate of girls. And I can hopefully at some point talk about, sort of the abnormalizing of boys. And that I see as one of the trends that is making diagnoses, autistic diagnoses spike. But I would say, no, that it's a very kind of complicated phenomenon to really understand why these numbers are spiking. I think that it's partly there's the well-intentioned practice of wanting to engage in early screenings for autism spectrum disorder. It's a public health imperative. But unfortunately, the younger in age we assess for autistic spectrum disorder, the greater the risk that a struggling or slow to mature toddler, especially boy, will be erroneously assigned a diagnosis, at least those that inhabit the mild end on the spectrum. I think toddlerhood is probably the period of greatest diagnostic uncertainty, and most of the new cases are, involve toddlers.
So what are the behaviors that therapists look for in toddlers, in young children, to diagnose autism?
Well, first, you should know that diagnosing true autism is not that difficult, in my estimation. So whenever we're talking about a clear-cut case of autism, there may not be language development, or there may be minimal language development. There may be that the subjective sense that a child is unreachable emotionally, that they're in their own world. They may have a blank stare on their face. They're sort of like they're relatively non-responsive or frequently non-responsive. They don't necessarily laugh when you laugh. They don't feed off others' emotions. So that would be a big sort of subjective criterion. They may be fascinated they may engage in a lot of seemingly unusual repetitious behaviors, spinning around in seats, staring at spinning fans. They may have tantrums that are prolonged, where they appear inconsolable if there's sort of small changes in routines. So I think on the extreme end, true autism, and I'm someone who really wants to reserve that diagnosis for kids that really are truly autistic for a variety of reasons that we can get into. But so in that regard, it's not particularly difficult to diagnose true autism. Where it becomes complicated is on the milder end, where most of the new, which applies to most of the new cases. So it's your, so now we call it autism spectrum disorder, and we see it as on a continuum from mild to severe, and it's on the mild end that it becomes, I would say, very kind of problematic to tease apart what is a true case of mild autism versus a child who's slow to mature or struggling in a variety of ways. And many mental health professionals are not trained to really distinguish between kind of the outer edges of normal, especially in toddlerhood, when it comes to, you know, tantruming, picky eating, social and emotional skills and whatnot.
Right. Sounds like toddler behavior. But what is the danger of diagnosing children with autism being on the autistic spectrum if they don't in fact have autism? Isn't there a danger in not acting on the suspicion that a child might be autistic? Aren't there some therapies that could mitigate the developing disorder if it's caught early enough in childhood?
Mary, that's a very good question. Here's the rub, that oftentimes a struggling toddler who may be slow to acquire language, who may tantrum out of the norm, who may have, gross and fine motor difficulties, and that, you know, and so there's challenges there, but they're really not autistic, oftentimes can benefit from the same services that are given to mildly autistic children. So it becomes this strange phenomenon where I think many parents get caught in the trap where they want the services, and so they reluctantly will embrace the diagnosis in order to get the services. I don't think that parents should be put in that quandary. I think that we should have a more liberal access to services that struggling children can get without having a diagnosis. So in other words, you shouldn't have to have a severe diagnosis in order to get certain speech and language services, in order to get occupational therapy, in order, you know, get social skills play therapy. I think those services should be kind of widely available because once you go down the track where the diagnosis is assigned, other dominoes can start to fall. A diagnosis can follow a child into the school system. Some educators and some school personnel will fetishize that diagnosis. It will shape their image of what that child is capable of. They may be categorized differently, perceived differently. And as long as the diagnosis follows that child, there can be other unanticipated negatives. So, you know, as that child gets older, there are a range of, especially in the world of social media, where employers do background checks, where, you know, we want to assume that medical records are safeguarded. You know, every month there's a new story that comes out in the newspaper about leakages of big data systems. That we can't assume that medical information will remain confidential. That information can get out. It can hurt a child's as they emerge into adulthood. It can affect their employment opportunities. There are lots of jobs, believe it or not, that you cannot get with certain diagnoses. In order to get an airline, you know, to become a pilot, certain, you know, positions in the military, law enforcement, high security jobs around the country, there are, you know, screened for mental illness. And so we want to assume as a society that we're much more liberal about mental illness, and we certainly talk about these diagnoses in very folksy ways, ADHD, bipolar disorder, autism. But when you really dig into the research, we as a society, the stigma of mental illness is every bit as strong as it was a generation ago. So we have to be careful assigning a serious autism is not a frivolous diagnosis. Neither is ADHD. And neither is bipolar disorder, which are the three most common diagnoses assigned to children these days. And I think we've just become far too casual in assigning what many veteran clinicians like myself have always believed are severe, lifelong, debilitating mental illnesses. And so we shouldn't assign these kinds of diagnoses casually just to get services.
That's the voice of Dr. Enrico Naulati. He's a clinical psychologist and the author of Back to Normal, Why Ordinary Childhood Behavior is Mistaken for ADHD, Bipolar Disorder, and Autism Spectrum Disorder. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, and I'm Sasha Lilly. Well, let's turn to one disorder that's diagnosed at even higher rates than autism, and that is ADHD, or Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder. One in 10 children are thought to have ADHD, which is a phenomenally large number. Perhaps you could just start by saying what the characteristics are that a child needs to have to merit that diagnosis.
Well, there's two different types. There's three different types. There's the ADHD, predominantly hyperactive type, and then there's the ADHD predominantly inattentive type, and then there's the combined type. So, you know, it's possible to have ADHD and not be sort of impulsive, hyperactive, you know, over-talk, be, you know, have problems waiting your turn, and this sort of thing, you can be forgetful, distractible, disorganized, have trouble kind of planning and following through, and still get the diagnosis. So, long story short, you're talking about kind of a grouping of symptoms that has to do with kids who are, to a fairly dysfunctional degree, impulsive, distractible, forgetful, disorganized, restless, and fidgety. Now, the trouble is that also parallels aspects of childhood itself, right? So all children, indeed, all children to varying degrees are, you know, impulsive, distractible, forgetful, disorganized, fidgety. And what gets considered ADHD or not is often based on the adults in a child's life, subjective comfort level with an effectiveness in handling these kinds of tendencies. So, and frankly, over the years, and I do a lot of assessing of ADHD, and I in some regards, I'm a traditionalist, even though, you know, I write critically of the diagnosis, but I still assess it in fairly conservative ways, and I distribute questionnaires. And I am really, really intrigued by the fact, and have been for decades, that I will distribute ADHD-type questionnaires to a variety of individuals, adults in a child's life, and I would say that probably only 25% of the time will I get sort of common profiles that converge on ADHD. So in other words, maybe I'll distribute it to two teachers, each of whom have radically different perceptions of a child, two parents, radically different perceptions of the same child. So it's very interesting to me that we underestimate just the subjective, and there really is no objective measure of ADHD. In other words, you can't peer into a child's brain, and that technology doesn't exist and might not ever exist. So we really rely on adults' subjective reports, in addition to other things, you know, tests of attention and concentration and whatnot. But to get the diagnosis, you have to be symptomatic in two different environments. So home and school, or home and church, or, you know, so it can't be that you're a child is symptomatic just in one environment. So actually studies line up with my own experience over the years that if you distribute questionnaires to adults that interact with children across environments, instead of just having a parent fill out a questionnaire and a parent alone or two parents alone, the incidences of ADHD drop by 40%. So, when it's being assessed, it should be, in order to get the diagnosis, you have to be symptomatic across two environments. Every evaluator should always have multiple adults in a child's life complete questionnaires so that it can actually be accurately diagnosed. But that is actually the exception rather than the rule currently, and one of the reasons why the diagnosis is you know, overutilized.
So what are the consequences then for a child of having this diagnosis? You mentioned earlier with autism that there can be a whole range of things that can follow that child even into adulthood in terms of the stigma. But with ADHD, what about medical interventions into childhood behavior at an early age?
Well, there you go. I mean, with autism, there's really no tailored medication. You may medicate certain symptoms if a child happens to tantrum a lot or whatnot. But the diagnosis of ADHD is almost a given then that child will be it will be recommended that medication be looked at. So a diagnosis of ADHD, as distinguished from autism, medication now becomes a primary consideration. And, you know, now you get into the whole topic of the pros and cons of medicating children where there's a questionable diagnosis.
And what are the consequences for the growing body of taking these drugs, especially if they are, in fact, unnecessary? Are there studies about the impact on children?
That to me is a very, very complicated question. And we, you know, depending on the age of the child, I mean, there are those that would say on like that, that we should be putting, you know, Ritalin in the water, so to speak, like fluoride for, you know, cavities. If there's a new generation of children that we're raising with like new media that have short attention spans that kind of, disadvantage them and, you know, chalk and talk classroom environments, why not should we just liberally prescribe it for performance reasons, you know, as a medicinal corrective for a nasty cultural trend? So there are those that would argue that. And so, you know, where's the harm, especially, you know, with the psychostimulants that have been researched for decades? And, you know, there are millions of children on them. There are risks and benefits. I can get into those if you want, but all the way to the other extreme where, you know, there are those that say we really don't know what long-term psychostimulant use, what the effects are on the brain. We actually, the research that I'm familiar with pretty much concludes, and actually this is some of the best research that's out there, that psychostimulants are scientifically supportable for up to about 2 years. The research shows that for about 2 years there are benefits for the majority of kids that have ADHD, but beyond 2 years, that's not the case. In fact, if you look at the research, upwards of 80% of children that are diagnosed with ADHD and put on medication by the time they're in their early 20s no longer take meds. And upwards of 75% of kids diagnosed with ADHD as children no longer meet the criteria for the disorder, you know, by the time they hit their mid-20s.
But is that because they're growing out of the disorder, or is that because they were misdiagnosed in the first place?
My position would be that large percentages of them were misdiagnosed in the first place, and I can present some of my ideas on kind of, you know, the confines between what I call normal childhood narcissism and ADHD, and we don't really fully appreciate what constitutes normal narcissism in children and how it can look on the surface like ADHD type phenomena, and I can talk about that in a little minute here. But I think it's massively overdiagnosed, as best as I can understand that, rooted in my knowledge of the literature, is that the ADHD brain is probably an immature brain, and there's actually been an NIMH brain scan study that's discovered that 75% of ADHD children outgrow it in their mid-20s, and that study concludes that what we assume is ADHD is really an immature brain. It's about 3 years behind in its maturation, and that what most kids that present like as ADHD in childhood are really slow to mature and their neurological and their social and emotional development, and they just need time.
So in other words, there's an unrealistic metric that's being applied to them about where they are in their development. And I guess is then the issue, and not just with ADHD, but also with autism spectrum disorder, even bipolar disorder. Are some of these things that we could say are really societal issues that have a disproportionate impact on children who might be maturing at a different rate, still within normal, but, you know, not the average? Is it, in a sense, easier to point the finger at the child than the society? I'm thinking about parental expectations and then schooling, the expectation that, especially for little kids and even older kids, that they're going to have to sit still easily for long periods of time. Is there a sort of cultural societal mismatch with children in general that particularly affects those who might be slow to mature?
Absolutely. I mean, and we, you know, if you look at kind of cultural trends just in terms of children's play experiences over the decades and their access to sort of safe places to play, I would say over the past 30, 40 years, children's play has gone from being more outdoors, more animated and kinetic, and more social, to indoors, sedentary, and isolative. So it's very hard to kind of maybe look for kind of causal relationships that, you know, has that contributed to the spike in ADHD children, you know, the lack of availability or reduced availability to active play experiences where kids can run around, jump around, climb, exhaust themselves in the act of play. I would say that that is a relevant consideration. There's even research that shows that in school districts where children are given more opportunities for free play, that they're afterwards, after recess, they're more capable of sitting calmly, less fidgety, and more attentively. So there are things like that. There's a great book called The ADHD Explosion by Stephen Henshaw, is one of the main authors. And in that book, they make the argument that you can look at, after the No Child Left Behind Federal Act, Education Act that was passed a number of years ago, you can trace the increases in ADHD diagnoses literally by the rate of implementation of it across the states. So the states that have the highest rates of ADHD happen to be the ones that, going back a decade or so, were the ones that first put the No Child Left Behind Act into practice. So some of your southern states, Virginia, North Carolina, have much higher rates of ADHD than, let's say, Nevada, California, Washington State, Oregon. Western states tend to have lower rates of ADHD. And in the ADHD Explosion book, they make the argument that that's just as an artifact of certain educational practices and certain perhaps unrealistic educational expectations that are placed on children that then make them symptomatic. And I would say that's especially boys.
Yes, well, I wanted to ask you about boys. Clearly, when you're looking at autism spectrum disorder or ADHD, boys are particularly likely to be diagnosed with these at much higher rates than girls. Why do you think that is?
That's a topic that's sort of near and dear, actually, to me. I mean, once again, I think I mentioned earlier, one in 54 boys are now diagnosed as autism spectrum disorder, about five times the rate of girls. Boys are given an ADHD diagnosis about three times the rate of girls. But partly, if we look, I think that there's a sort of now I'm going to say some things that might be controversial to your audience, but I think we're at a place in our culture where there's a sort of a phobia around talking about gender. But if you're the parent of a boy, if you've spent any time around boys in a variety of settings, educationally, clinically, whatever, it meets the eye fairly readily. Some general gender-based differences meet the eye fairly readily. So boys, if you look at boys, the average boy's communication style, they're more likely to be logical, analytical, transactional, long-winded monologues about their favorite topics, may avoid eye contact, may be brusque and blunt, they may be more likely to engage in what's called shoulder-to-shoulder intimacy than face-to-face intimacy. In other words, a verbal process will kick in while they're pursuing an activity together. Even if it's playing video games, then, you know, like they, many mothers wish that they could take their sons to lunch and sit across the table and have a wonderful conversation and then repeatedly get disappointed, desiring face-to-face intimacy when what may come natural to that boy is something that's more shoulder-to-shoulder intimacy, as in going for a bike ride together, or you know, picking weeds together, or you know, some activity that then can that helps lubricate the interaction. So you've got that going on. The average boy's play during toddler years is autistic-like. The average boy prefers playing alone and manipulating toys in a rote fashion than using them to play make-believe. Actually, if you look at the theory of mind, which is considered one of the hallmarks of autism, that is a child's ability to sort of like put themselves in someone else's shoes, put themselves in the mind of others. Like, I have a lot of puppets in my office. You know, I ask what the puppet's sort of thinking or feeling. And so the theory of mind, being able to sort of project one's, you know, extrapolate from the outside about, like, what an object or a person may be sort of thinking or feeling. The average 3 to 4-year-old girl is about twice as capable of theory of mind than the average boy. So just as a function of gender. So that's another reason why it gets overdiagnosed in boys. Plus with toddlerhood too, there are a range of behaviors that are typical of toddlers that can get misconstrued as autistic-like. About 1 in 5 toddlers are late talkers. About 50% of toddlers are picky eaters. About 1/3 of parents of toddlers find their tantrums disturbing or disquieting. So, you know, and toddlerhood is a time of stubbornness, willfulness, insisting on having control over what happens to their bodies or events around them. Stubbornness, that can at times get misconstrued as autistic-like fixation on things staying the same, and, you know, problems transitioning, being overly wedded to a routine. These sorts of phenomena are considered autistic-like, but they're also very developmentally appropriate for toddlers. Toddlerhood is also a period where a repetition of stimulating activities is necessary to build mastery. So stacking blocks over and over in a seemingly self-absorbed, immersed way, lining up trains in the same way over and over to obtain an experience of kinetic effectiveness and mastery, that's very consistent with toddlerhood, especially among boys. And, you know, to the unsophisticated eye, that can appear autistic-like. And then the procedures and assessment conditions geared towards when autism is being assessed can often put a vulnerable or struggling toddler over the edge, making them seem autistic-like in their ways of coping. And this is the one – I don't think that we address that issue enough in terms of the overdiagnosis problem. So even with little, like, 2-year-olds, the traditional way that they're assessed for autism is that they're separated from a parent or their caregiver fairly early on in the interview. And then there's a very formal way of assessing it that for most toddlers who are attachment sensitive, that need to be put at ease in order to bring the best out in them developmentally, if they're the formality, the unintended formality of the assessment procedure itself, can leave that toddler ill at ease. And then there are more primal ways of coping, you know, not engaging in eye contact, crawling under a table, whining, becoming non-communicative. These are fairly primal coping mechanisms of toddlers, they can make them look autistic-like. So it's another, especially with boys too, who may be less social to begin with. So these are some of the reasons, I think, where boys get kind of, there's a you know, and we're not talking about sort of malicious acts on the part of, you know, mental health professionals, and we're talking about perhaps just a need to address the question of gender and how boys develop differently from girls and how boys at times cope differently from girls and so on and so forth. Those more developmental topics and common sense topics, I think, need to be factored into the assessment procedure.
Sure, and those questions of gender are obviously very complicated, how it comes to be that boys turn out one way and girls turn out another. And although they're not being diagnosed with autism and ADHD at the same level as boys are, clearly there are also girls who are seen as exhibiting abnormal behavior to whatever expectations there are about girl behavior, you know, very active, physically active little girls, and then they get branded abnormal as well, maybe not given these diagnoses, but, you know, that there seem to be fairly rigid ideas about what is normal, and children who fall beyond that can really end up, you know, in a bad situation.
Yeah, well, especially in a classroom setting. I mean, I think that, you know, what is a normal activity level? What is a normal attention span? What is, you know, a normal, not all children are people, are social and given to be social and may be more introverted by temperament than extroverted. And I say it, I actually think that even though in America we want to see ourselves as embracing diversity, one of the areas I think where we're probably, you know, less likely to embrace that diversity is in the social and emotional realm. Being able to kind of adapt educational, pedagogical environments to children across a range of temperaments, activity levels, attention spans, and whatnot.
Dr. Enrico Naulati is my guest. We'll return with him in just a moment. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with Enrico Naulati. He's a clinical psychologist specializing in childhood and adolescent therapy and assessment, author of the book Back to Normal, Why Ordinary Childhood Behavior is Mistaken for ADHD, Bipolar Disorder, and Autism Spectrum Disorder. That's published by Beacon Press, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. I'd like to turn now to a diagnosis that is frequently made within adolescence, and that is bipolar disorder. There's been an explosion of diagnosis of bipolar disorder. And I wonder if you could tell listeners what are the characteristics of bipolar disorder and then how they get frequently, as you see it, confused with normal, albeit sometimes unpleasant behavior.
Well, classic bipolar disorder, it used to be called manic depressive illness, not unlike autism, I think, on the surface when it's present in its clearest form, is relatively easy to diagnose. So some of the hallmarks of bipolar disorder, what clinicians call it a labile mood, someone who can go from being relatively chipper and upbeat to tearful or enraged, with some minor kind of precipitant, so true mood swings, what triggers that those mood swings on the surface seem fairly inconsequential. So you've got that. you know, a high degree of impulsivity, you know, a lack of a need for sleep. So someone who might go a day or two without sleep, impulsively calling family members in the middle of the night. Maybe they're hypersexual and impulsively acting out sexually. There's also what's called tangential thinking. So a person may jump around and their verbalizations going from one thought to another without there being, you know, a great deal of internal consistency with sort of what they're talking about. And then pressured speech is one of the hallmarks of bipolar disorder. Motor mouth, someone who just is talking endlessly with pressure, like they can't help but say what needs to be said and say it as long as it needs to be said. These are some of the hallmarks of bipolar disorder. The criteria shifted about, you know, about 20 years ago that really then created, I would say, sort of a dragnet for teenagers that are going through a fairly difficult adolescent passage to be misdiagnosed. So agitation became one of the hallmarks of adolescent bipolar disorder or pediatric bipolar disorder. So kids who would just had a short fuse and would flare up and agitation. So teenagers who really showed unusual signs of just becoming enraged and slamming doors, yelling, screaming, becoming highly argumentative. Teenagers with that presentation now were more likely to be assigned a diagnosis, to the exclusion of some of these other classic symptoms of bipolar disorder, which was always kind of confusing to me. Merely a kid who was just sort of like agitated and impulsive to unusual levels. Ooh, now that would be a kid that in the current zeitgeist would be on a clinician's radar to get a diagnosis of bipolar disorder.
Adolescents are, of course, famously known for not getting enough sleep. And I was wondering how much of this is a factor in the behaviors that then are perhaps misdiagnosed as psychiatric disorders.
I have a whole section in my book on that, and I agree with that basic premise. Like kids that have chronic sleep deprivation and overuse caffeine in ways that can impair their sleep, can present with reduced self-regulation of emotion in general, so more irritable, more moody, more cranky, shorter fuse, and cognitively cloudy, and problems concentrating and attending. Yeah, I think that chronic sleep deprivation is probably one possible pathway to a false diagnosis.
The program's Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and I'm joined by clinical psychologist Enrico Nalotti, author of Back to Normal. Well, let's talk about this bigger picture that you've been discussing through the hour of what you see as the overdiagnosis of various psychiatric disorders. Attention deficit hyperactivity disorder being one, bipolar disorder, autism spectrum disorder. What drives this overdiagnosis? You've talked about it in different ways, but I wonder what are the key facets that have led to such an increase in these diagnoses from this generation to the last. You've mentioned somewhat the orientation of doctors and therapists in making diagnoses. To what degree does their education influence the tendency to give children psychiatric diagnoses?
Well, I can start there, but I think there's a complex web of factors that sort of explain these diagnoses that we've been discussing. I mean, I agree with you that the sort of the education and training of health and mental health professionals often lacks adequate background in child development. And, you know, they often don't have a good paradigm in their head for what constitutes normal. And what they do have is often of a textbook academic nature. They may be well-versed in identifying abnormality, but have a hard time teasing out what is on the outer edges of normal, comparing that to what is actually abnormal. So it has partly to do with the education and training of health and mental health professionals. You know, as upwards of like 40% of new child psychologists haven't taken any courses in child development. 40% of pediatricians haven't even completed a residency in pediatric mental health. So, you know, that it has to do with the education training of health and mental health professionals. It has to do with, you know, the obvious, the spectacular marketing success of the pharmaceutical industry, making the American public easygoing about medicalizing and medicating children's behavior. I think as a society, we become casual, loose, and folksy in discussing childhood diagnoses. So much so that by the time a parent enters a doctor's office, they sort of nonchalantly self-diagnose their child. I mean, if you've watched Simpson episodes, South Park episodes, you know, their shows on ADHD, they showcase ADHD in popular culture in ways. We hype the word hyperactive, the term short attention span, forgetful, ADHD. We use it in such folksy ways, most new cases of ADHD occur in a pediatrician's office. The average length of a pediatric visit right now is about 15 minutes. So, you know, if a parent comes in already predisposed to kind of use symptom language, and they confront the pediatrician who wants them to cut to the chase and use clinical shorthand to arrive at a diet, you could see how the conditions seem to promote a quick diagnosis. The diagnostic habits of mental health professionals have also changed. There's much more of a trend towards what's called upcoding or rebranding. In other words, assigning a more severe diagnosis in order to authorize services through insurance companies. Insurance companies have just become much tighter in what they'll approve of in the way of services. And many clinicians adapt by upcoding, assigning a more severe diagnosis in order to just authorize services. So these are some of the reasons why I think over the past few generations we've seen, you know, an uptick or a big uptick in, you know, these diagnoses.
Can you tell us a bit more about the role that pharmaceutical companies play in influencing the diagnosis that children get around these mental health disorders?
Well, one of the big ones, of course, it has to do with a pediatric bipolar disorder. In fact, it's only now that we've really seen the light, so to speak, that pharmaceutical companies promoting what are called off-label uses of what are called the newer antipsychotics. These are medications like Abilify, Seroquel, Geodon, Zyprexa, Risperdal. These medications are extraordinarily profitable. In fact, Abilify, I believe it was in 2014, was the most profitable drug of any drug in America, and it's used for treating bipolar disorder. And one of the reasons that drug in particular and the others that I just quoted have been prescribed in skyrocketing rates is deeply wedded to the more looser and more frequent diagnosis of pediatric bipolar disorder. The pharmaceutical industry went out of its way to handsomely reward psychiatrists and pediatricians who would openly promote the uses of these off-label uses. They're not approved, many of them, by the FDA for use with an approved medication for pediatric bipolar disorder, but physicians are allowed to prescribe medications for what are called off-label reasons, and the pharmaceutical companies sort of took full advantage of that loophole going back a decade or two and promoting these newer antipsychotics that became highly profitable and really shaped many clinicians' diagnostic habits. We're just coming to terms with that right now. A lot of the abuses in the system have been uncovered, and there are new rules that are applying. I think under the Obama administration that physicians can only get like $1,000 or something like that if they give a talk to a pharmaceutical, you know, from a pharmaceutical company to promote a medication. Before, it was the sky was the limit. And doctors could make millions of dollars flying around using kind of sketchy research to promote off-label uses, in particular of the newer antipsychotics, to address pediatric bipolar disorder.
Well, let me end by asking you, what do you think parents should do if they feel like their children are exhibiting worrisome behavior or simply difficult behavior?
I would say you start by exercising common sense. You start, like you said earlier, Sasha, I look for the obvious things first: sleeping, eating, the emotional tenor of the household. Are things relatively smooth and calm enough of the time, or chaotic too much of the time? Children are, we underestimate how attachment sensitive they are. If you have an occupation that makes you highly preoccupied a lot of the time, your physical coming and going sort of erratic, when you come home, when you pick a child up after school, that time varies from day to day, that alone, an erratic attachment pattern throughout early childhood can create a symptomatic child. So you start with the obvious things first. Is there a mismatch between a child's educational environment and where they're at developmentally? So I would say first start there. Then get if the problems persist, then I think it's time to try to seek out a qualified mental health professional. And unfortunately, I think you're going to have to do your research to find someone who is not only credentialed, but who, you know, has a broad knowledge of normal childhood, and that maybe they themselves have kids, or they themselves were once a teacher, or they themselves once worked in a summer camp. They themselves came from a big family and were put in a parental role with siblings. Believe it or not, I think that these normal human things are, you know, add to a child psychologist's skill level and repertoire.
I've been speaking with Enrico Naulati. He's a clinical psychologist specializing in childhood and adolescent therapy and assessment. He is the author of Back to Normal, Why Ordinary Childhood Behavior is Mistaken for ADHD, Bipolar Disorder, and Autism Spectrum Disorder. That's published by Beacon Press. You can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. Thank you so much for joining me today.
You are very welcome, Sasha.
You've been listening to Against the Grain. My name is Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song.
please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.